recitation of the kinos was probably among the more difficult tasks that we have in the course of our year, our liturgical year, if you will, just for a number of reasons. Certainly the words of many of the kinos, which are written in a very poetic style, are difficult. They're not the usual types of words that people are familiar with in davening, and it becomes sometimes a challenge to understand the basic point of the kinos. So today, in our time, we do have many different translations of the kinos, which has obviated that problem, at least to some extent. But besides that, it's difficult, as I indicated last night, to be in the mood that I think Chazal wished us to be in. We mentioned last night that we know that the Tisha B'Av was nikba, was established as a day of bechiyah, b'chos yichke b'layla, in terms of last night. And in general, it's a day of bechiyah, the Tzukim Haftarah that we just read, also call us to the concept of crying, although interestingly enough, it says in Haftarah, you have to summon the experts, kirul hamekononos. And some of the people who are experts in knowing how to weep and to get others to do the same. I think that is the context in which, or the theme in which the background, so to speak, in which the kinnos were written, to have experts, people who were great, and we'll see as we recite the kinnos, great authorities and great Talmid Chachamim who wrote kinnos, because they're the experts. They are the so-called mekononos, as it were, whose works inspire us to weep and to cry. And last night I mentioned, of course, that the bechiah has at least two different aspects. There's weeping, tears of sorrow. I mentioned last night at least an anocha, at least a groan. There's also tears of hope, and those themes are found in the kinnos as well. Many of the kinnos, as we'll see, are plays on words from Megillas Eicha, and indeed, as Soloveitchik was fond of pointing out, the very fact that we can ask the question, how could this be? Ordinarily, you know, we don't have the right to challenge HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to question, but since the path was blazed already by Yirmiyahu HaNavi in Megillas Eicha, he raised the question, so we have the right, so to speak, to continue and ask, how could this be? And in a certain sense, challenge HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and as we'll see in the kinnos, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has good answers, not surprisingly. But the very fact that we can ask the question is based upon that which appears in Megillas Eicha. The Rav was fond of pointing out as well that, you know, our entire religious system, our entire body of religious behavior is based upon action. We have mitzvahs maishios, things that we have to do, but it's also based on having certain feelings in mind. And in the realm of avelus, certainly avelus is belayed. A person feels something. On the other hand, there are requirements, halachic requirements, things that one must do, things that one must refrain from doing, Rachmana l'shlan, when in a situation of avelus. The Rav suggested that the recitation of kinos is, as it were, the kumva asei of the avelus of Tisha B'Av. We have restrictions on Tisha B'Av, we sit on the floor, we don't bathe, and so on, restrictions that are similar, again, Rachmana l'shlan, to somebody who is observing Shiva after the death, God forbid, of a relative. Those are more passive kinds of requirements, but the kumva asei, the active demonstration, so to speak, of avelus is the recitation of kinnos. Now, it's interesting that the Kriyas HaTorah that we just learned from Parshas L'Eschanan, Kisoli Vanim of Nevanim, has become, of course, and that's the practice that we follow, the learning for Tisha B'Av morning. If you look in the Gemara, that wasn't the original practice. At least not in all places. The Gemara records that in some places the practice was to read the story of the Meraglim. So sections from Parshas Shlach as the Kriyas HaTorah for Tisha B'Av morning. Makes good sense because, as again we mentioned last night, the Gemara in Tainus works out that the story of the Meraglim, the rebellion at that time, happened on Tisha B'Av. That was the first Tisha B'Av, so to speak, in Jewish history. The Gemara has a cheshbon of the dates work out. It doesn't specify in the Chumash exactly that it happened on the 9th of Av, but the Gemara works it out at the end of Tainus. And that was the first of Tisha B'Av, and in fact, the Gemara there indicates that Tisha B'Av became identified as the day of Bechiel Adoros because of that event that happened the first time, that first Tisha B'Av. So it's certainly appropriate to read the story of the Meraglim, the one story that's in the Chumash that happened on Tisha B'Av as the laning for Tisha B'Av morning. But again, that's not our practice. The Gemara says that Abaye comments on Idna Nahogalma, the current practice, and it's so out of Yom HaZeh, is to read Kisol Idbonim. What does Kisol Idbonim have to do with Tisha B'Av? Other than a general kind of comment that there'll be tzaris and so on, but again, the reading of Shlach would have been a good choice, was a good choice. But the Rav made a number of suggestions in terms of Kisol Idbonim. First of all, the opening phrase, Kisol Idbonim uvnei vonim and oshantem ba'aretz. You'll go into Eretz Yisrael, you'll have children, grandchildren, you'll be there for a long time, and then you'll become corrupt and so on. So the question is that the case that Dafka only after you have children and grandchildren, you're there for a long time, it's conceivable that these people themselves, and really that's what Moshe was talking to, maybe it's themselves that become corrupt and become old Eved Zara and so on. Why the emphasis on Kisolid Vanim, Uvnei Vanim, and so on? And the answer is, perhaps, as I've suggested, that the key word is v'noshantem. When you're there a long time, when something becomes old or considered old-fashioned, the people who experience divine revelation, HaKadosh Baruch Hu who's leading the Jews out of Mitzrayim and so on, perhaps, would have had a different approach. But as time goes on, and as you're talking to the grandfather and the great-grandfather, and he's telling of what he went through, it becomes, as generations continue, perhaps less and less relevant. And it's hard to listen sometimes to somebody from Doros before relate what happened to them. It becomes less and less relevant. And we see today, you know, 65 or so years after the Holocaust, there are people who question whether it ever even happened. Not people on Anshei Shlomeinu, but people in the world question whatever happened. How many people are left? And every passing year, there are less and less people around who experienced it. So today, you know, you have the ability to record things, and people have made archives and museums and so on. But nonetheless, it becomes less relevant unless it's kept relevant. Yetzias Mitzrayim also happened a long time ago. But the Torah tells us that there's a requirement on Pesach night to tell the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim. And the Mishnah frames it in the idea that every person has to view himself as though he personally came out of Mitzrayim. That's how you keep it alive. You talk about it, you make it a live event. And we all know from the halachas of Pesach and the halachas of the Seder that part of what the whole Seder is about is to re-experience Kilu Yotzo and Mitzrayim. We want the kids to ask questions and a whole setup on Pesach night designed to make the event not something that happened thousands of years ago, but in the language of the Rambam, actually, Kiyubu Yotza Ato, that I am now from Mitzrayim. The Rav suggested that perhaps that's the idea on Tisha B'Av as well. We have to view ourselves as though we personally experienced this suffering. The Gemara tells us that Kol Dor, any generation which has not witnessed the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, such as ours, is to be considered as though the Beis HaMikdash were destroyed in its days. So perhaps the recitation of Kinos is designed to create that atmosphere, to give us an opportunity to relate to it as though it recently happened. And I always suggest that's why maybe there are many, many Kinos. You know, I mean, people read the Kinos, and some of them seem repetitious, and how many do you need, and why there's so many, and one can certainly make the case historically. I'm not an expert, but you look in, you know, the writings of scholars on the subject, you know, so different kinnas were said in different communities, and somehow, you know, we kind of merged them all. But you say something over and over again, so it becomes more alive. It becomes something which you can relate to better. So that's one thing the Rav said, that that's the idea of an oshantem ba'aretz. That's when people view things as old-fashioned, they lose the hislavos, so there's a requirement to reset it up, so to speak. So that's maybe one idea. When things become too old-fashioned, too mechanical, we need to straighten it out and pretend, so to speak, as though we're hearing it for the first time. The other point, the Rav had a whole group, I'm not going to say them all now, book that was published a couple of years ago, The Lord is Righteous in All His Ways, by Rabbi Jacob Joe Shachter, based on his, the Rav used to say kinnah, I remember, the Rav used to say kinnahs, you know, they were in Maimonides' yeshiva in Boston, so they would daven shachris, and he said not till the early mincha, I think he said till the late mincha, till 5-6 o'clock, he would just go all day, you know, explaining the kinnahs, people would come and go, That's how he did it. So there's a lot of material that he had. I'm not going to go through everything he said on this subject, but he mentions just a couple of others. The pasuk says that you'll become like he sold one of the nevanim, and you'll make for yourself various idols and so on. So the Rav noted, it doesn't say you'll worship them; it just says you'll make them. And he noted that this is the challenge, so to speak, in Golis. Because people think, you know, well, I'll just make believe, so to speak. I'll kind of blend in. I'll do something that I won't stand out as being so different and so apart. So it's a little thing about Sisem. I'm not going to worship it, right? But Sisem Pesel Tzmanas Kol. I'm not going to worship the Pesel. I'm just going to make it in case anyone's walking in the neighborhood sees, oh, he's like one of us as well. Of course, it's extremely dangerous because eventually one thing leads to another, and little by little, identifying with many of the things in the society around us can impact us. Eventually, it becomes part of our culture as well. That's one thing that the Psukim are warning us about, so to speak. And therefore, again, recalling that Tisha B'Av took place, the destruction of the first Beis Hamikdash was because the Jews abandoned even the most basic of Jewish principles. Perhaps that's an idea to bring up in the laning, that, you know, we think that sometimes we can blend in and it won't impact our religious behavior, but of course that's not the case. The concept of Golus will be scattered among all the nations. So certainly that's an obvious theme to speak about in the laning as it did, and to speak about on Tisha B'Av. And eventually, however, we cast a misham as Hashem Elokecha. Eventually the time comes that we will do tshuva. And that too, as we'll see, is a theme that's inherent in some of the kinos. Many of the kinos end on a flat note. It's wailing, screaming, how could this such a thing happen? But later on in the kinos, as we'll see, there are answers and there are things that we have to do. Tshuva is brought in, again, in Eicha itself, Nachusod Rechino Nachkor V'Nashuva Hashem, right, the tzukim that indicate that we have to do tshuva. And the pasuk tells us in the Leini, setting the tone, the Shavtar, Hashem Elokecha, and so on, will come a time when the Jewish people will do tshuva, and the Golus will eventually end. The truth is, it's interesting, just as an aside, notice that in the Haftarah, there really was no ending of Nechama. The overwhelming majority of the time, even Shabbos Chazon, the Haftarah ends on a positive note. Even the darkest Haftarahs, even the Haftarahs and Nevuahs, which have so much tragedy foretold, but they end on a positive note. Sometimes you have to skip a few psukim or skip to another section. And so the one exception we spoke about in passages, Parshas Vayeshev, has no positive note. I think I spoke about it in shul more than one occasion. The Rav noted that there's this end, Vayeshev Milo Yirah, Shem Elokim Diber Milo Yinoveh. The Parshas Vayeshev is perhaps devoid of a positive ending in Haftarah, because that's the first indication of Golus of the Jewish people. Parshas Vayeshev is, of course, the story of Yosef and his brothers, and that led to the initial Golus in Mitzrayim. And the Rav, and I heard this year directly, the Rav said that we don't have Nechama. And I mean, that was the disaster. Bikes Yaakov Leishev B'Shalva. Yaakov, first thought that everything's good. He's back in Eretz Yisrael. It's going to be Mashiach side, so to speak, everything's going to be wonderful, and then all of a sudden, Tzoras and Yosef and the brothers altered the course of Jewish history forever. So, that Haftarah is no Nechama, but the Haftarah of Tisha B'Av morning also doesn't really have a Nechama, Perhaps one of the reasons is that in general, we don't offer nechama to somebody who is misha mesha mutalapanav. You know, we have shiva, a person sits shiva after burying a relative, so after the shiva, people come, during the shiva rather, people come in the menachem avel. That's the mitzvah of nechama velim. But ain't menachem, you don't, the Gemara tells us, you don't comfort somebody at the time when the grief is so intense. So on Tisha B'Av morning, the grief is intense. However, the fact is that the Torah does have at least this concept that we will do tshuva, and eventually HaKadosh Baruch Hu will respond. And so some of the themes, and there are others, but for now that will suffice, but some of the themes which are gone through in the laning are repeated, so to speak, and developed in some of the kinnas as we see. I just want to call your attention to one other thing, and basically I'll just mention now. We'll extend the rest of time. I'll try and introduce each kinnah with a few words about its theme. As the people come and go, we'll say, we'll recite their kinnahs till around 1:30, and shortly thereafter we'll daven mincha. Somebody has to leave, just to remind you to say the end of davening, to say Ashrei and Valtzion, and Elena, which we'll say later. Idea of the kinnas is not just to say the words, but to try and understand as well. That's the practice we follow. I'll just mention, in terms of the opening kinna, Shavas Suru Meni Shimuni Ovrai, or Ovrai, Schimos HaShimuni. I want to call your attention to two things in that opening phrase. First of all, Shavas. Shavas means everything stopped. By the way, the kinna begins, it appears to be the middle of the kinna. A different approaches. The fact is that the practice at one time was that kinnas were recited in the Shmon Esrei. I mentioned a little bit on Shabbos, you know, we're accustomed to piyutim, let's say from Yom Noroim, or in some communities in Shal Shagolim, a piyuta, or on the Arba Parshios, piyutim that are inserted into the Chazoras HaShatz. And around these parts, it's not that common other than on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. But when you look in the Siddurim, regular Siddurim, print Piyutim for Parshas Zohar and Parshas Shkolim, you know, the Arba Parshos, and there are Piyutim for the Shal Shagolim, that the old fasted Machzorim, and even some new Machzorim print. Usually we don't have any Piyutim in the weekday Shmona Esrei, except I mentioned on Shabbos Purim. Many Siddurim print what's called the Krovitz on Purim. It's not so commonly recited around here, but it's printed a lot of the Siddurim, and Tisha B'Av as well. There were practices that actually, in the brachas of the Shmona Esrei, people inserted phrases or basically kinos, which were built into the Chazoras HaShatz. And it appeared that one of the opening ones, this is the second part of it. The Shavas Surimeni is after the Shmona Esrei was finished, so they continued right off, you know, from here. So again, our practice, and I've never seen it done actually I've seen it printed, but I've never seen it done in the Shmona Esrei. But that's why this kinnah begins at this point. But in any point, you know, to the letter Sama, many of the kinnahs, just to point out, as does Eicha, follows the aleph beis pattern in one form or another, forwards, backwards, with various intricate arrangements sometimes. But this kinnah seems to be beginning with the Sama, but that explains why. Anyway, it says Shavas, so the opening word Shavas means it stopped. And the truth of the matter is, what is it that stopped? What stopped was Jewish life as it had been previously. Jewish life was never the same again after the Churban as it was before. It's almost like everything we knew till now stopped. You know, that's a feeling that people sometimes have. I can't speak from first-hand experience, but from things that I've read and even people I've spoken to, you know, people who survived the Holocaust and went back to the town, the shtetl in Europe where they came from, didn't recognize the place. It was like everything had stopped. There was no resemblance what they saw just a few years later, you know, what had been before. Places which were, you know, hustling and bustling centers of Jewish activity with shuls and yeshivas and communal organizations and so on. So, of course, all of that ended. The people who, you know, I once said this to a relative of mine, they went back to where they come from. It was like a surreal kind of experience. It was, nothing was the same as it had been not that many years earlier. But everything just stopped. It ended. So that's what we say here. Shavas. Right? With the Korban HaBayis, Jewish life ceased to be the way it had been before. But I call your attention as well to the phrase, Sechiya Ma'os HaShimuni, Yadvei Chavirai. It's an important point because, and I think I'll try and focus on it to some extent during the kinnis today, I don't know if we've focused on that theme in previous years, but what there was as well with the Korban is the loss of Jewish dignity. The Rav spoke about this and others have commented this as well. The Korban, besides in the center of Jewish life, the Beis HaMikdash being destroyed, and the Beis HaMikdash is the center of Avoda and Tefillah, and everything the Beis HaMikdash represents, that we understand. But there was something else as well. The Jewish people became a downtrodden and oppressed people, which, you know, exists to some extent. There's no shortage of anti-Semitism today. We don't experience it, thank God, that often or that regularly here, living where we do. Baruch Hashem, you know, the United States has treated the Jews well for the most part. Moshe Feinstein referred to it in his tshuva as a malchus shel chesed. You know, it's a kind government, but still, we know that there are people, you know, there are anti-Semites around today in the United States as well, even if they can't always act on it. And in Europe and in other places, anti-Semitism lives in it as well. Unfortunately. And the Jewish people are mocked, and the Jewish people are downtrodden and treated as pariahs. Much of it is directed today towards the state of Israel. That's really just a hidden, or the, you know, it's an excuse. It's not the state of Israel, it's the Jews that are the problem. And that really is what happened after the Churban. Schiyu Ma'os Hesimuni. And that has been, unfortunately, something, Schiyu Ma'os, these things which are disgusting and horrible, abominable. That's what's happened to us. And so, that we'll see as a theme. Now, is that important, or do we care about dignity? Well, the answer is we do. On the one hand, one could argue we do what we have to do, and who cares what anybody thinks. However, there is such a concept as dignity of Klal Yisrael, because the dignity of Klal Yisrael ultimately reflects the dignity of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We say in the davening on Yom Noraim, and on Yom Tov as well, Atav HaKartano and so on, V'rom Mamtano Mikol HaLashonos, HaKadosh Baruch Hu lifted us up, V'rom Mamtano. So if we are considered downtrodden and abused and mocked, in a certain sense, the same is true of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I once heard that Rabbi Nachum Zemba, who was the leader of Polish Jewry before the war, Rabbi Nachum Zemba died in the Warsaw Ghetto, I think during the Warsaw Ghetto uprising, which he supported. Now, there was a question. People came to him, great Talmud Chacham. Most of his works, I think, were lost. We have the Sefer on Shabbos, the Tosfos Chaim, and then there's some Tshuvos that he corresponded with Zarav Rome, but we don't. I don't think there's gotten something on the Sefri. I think much of Nachum Zemba's writings were lost. But again, a Gaon Hotzum, a leader of the Polish Jewry, and he was asked, you know, when they were planning the Warsaw Ghetto uprisings, at least some people wanted to consult him. And, you know, should we do this? After all, it's a hopeless kind of battle. We're going to lose anyways, and we're going to get killed anyhow. You know, I don't think they really had the full confidence that they were going to be able to defeat the Nazis. But nonetheless, they, okay, at least some people asked the opinion of Rabbi Nachum Zemba, and he responded by saying as follows, is Nekama a good thing or a bad thing? On the one hand, Nekama is a law in the Torah, lo sikom velo sitor, right? You're not allowed to take revenge. On the other hand, kel Nekamos Hashem. Because Baruch Hu takes revenge. So which is it? So the answer is, of course, it depends upon the motivation. It depends upon where one is coming. But if a person is being Toveya, the cover of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so then Nekama is important. You're insulted because somebody wouldn't lend you something, and therefore next time you say you don't lend him, so that's Nekama, because you're Toveya only your own feeling. That's inappropriate. But if you're being Toveya, you're mumming the dignity of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so then it can be Kel Nekamos Hashem. And again, the way that I heard the story, the Menachem Zemba supported the Warsaw Ghetto uprising because we have to stand up for our dignity as a people. And there's a way to do that. Again, maybe it was different because they knew they were going to be killed anyway. With or without the Warsaw Ghetto uprising, they would have been killed. So again, I'm not trying to paskin on the base of this, or, you know, there's a very, very complicated issue, a complicated shiloh, but I just want to bring out the point that it's necessary sometimes to stand up, not the own part. Someone's example, the Chazal gives, someone doesn't lend you a hammer, so next time you don't lend him the hammer, okay, you know, that's called sikom. When it's being toveya, the dignity of Kal Yisrael, and hence the dignity of our Kadosh Baruch Hu, something different than somebody who's born in mind. So again, we'll recite each kina, you know, and beforehand I'll explain it. And again, I remind those who have to leave early to finish the davening, and we expect to go till about 1:30. Shavas to remaining shulman. Just to mention the kina that we just finished, also things that come up again, and that is, you know, it said Karos Yoshi Kivon Odeheng Zermuni. We called our allies, and they deceived us as well. It's an important point to bear in mind through the recitation of kinas also. Again, we see it today. People who are allegedly friends and supporters sometimes turn against us as well. Ultimately, we, you know, Hanam Levoda Yishkon, that we're very much alone in many ways. The next kina begins with the words Eicha Atzer Ve'Apecha, and by the way, I just mentioned we're following the regular Nusach Ashkenaz, the Art Scroll, and other edition of the kinas follow that order. Those who have the edition of Rabbi Rosenfeld, that edition, sometimes the order is slightly different. I mean, they're all there, but the order is slightly different. So I'll introduce each one with the opening phrase so you can follow. Eicha Atzer Ve'Apecha. So what we have here is a kina that each stanza begins with the word Eicha. Again, we mentioned before that we have the right to call out Eicha because that's what Yirmiyahu HaNavi did. And that's the opening word of each stanza. And the sort of refrain is Zechor Hashem Mehoyalonu, which is the opening pasuk of the last parak hey of Megillos Eicha, Zechor Hashem Mehoyalonu. Remember our Kadosh Baruch Hu, what has happened to us. So basically what this kina does is contrast our relationship with our Kadosh Baruch Hu at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim the development of Klal Yisrael in their first early years, and what happened now, we say Zechor Hashem Mehayalon, and we say, you know, how do these terrible things happen? V'lo Zocharta, Kadosh Baruch Hu, you didn't remember. So, for example, Eicha Atzta V'Apecha, how were you so angry and you rushed in your anger to destroy us in the hands of our enemies? The lo zacharta, you didn't remember the bris ben absarim. That's how each stanza goes. You didn't remember. Not that HaKadosh Baruch Hu forgot, but he made like he didn't remember. It's interesting that the Gemara tells us that we have such a concept called Zechus Avos. We have merit, Zechus Avos, of our ancestors, merit of our ancestors. Sadly, however, the Gemara says in Masechet Shabbos and Daf Nun Hei that eventually, in the days of Yechezkel, Korban Bayis Rishon, Tomas Zechus Avos. Zechus Avos ended. It was no longer accepted as a sort of a mitigating factor, a mitigating circumstance. There's no more Zechus Avos. Just because HaKadosh Baruch Hu loved Avram and Yitzchak and Yaakov, it doesn't work anymore automatically. So Tosus raises the kasha, what do you mean? Don't we daven every day, alakei Avram, alakei Yitzchak, alakei Yaakov? I mean, aren't we calling upon Zechus Avos, so to speak, regularly in our davening? What do you mean, Tomas Zechus Avos? It's true, so then we shouldn't say that in the davening. We shouldn't speak about all the time about Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So the Tom answers the difference that yes, although Tomas Zechus Avos, but Bris Avos, lo Tomas. Right, the covenant with our avos didn't expire. The bris, that's everlasting. What's the chus avos? The Rebbe gave an example. Let's say I have a close friend, and I see him, we're very friendly, and then after a while, the person unfortunately passes away, so he leaves over a son who has a very similar appearance. Son looks very much like him. So my fondness for the father will now transfer to the son. I see the son, I think about the father. Looks like him, the kid looks like him. And then, they don't say, just in the imaginary case, person outlives everybody, so the son dies, and he has a son. The son looks less like the original father, but there's still some resemblance. So after a while, in the example, you know, the child doesn't look at all like the original father anymore. So, you know, my friendship's not going to be automatically channeled. Look at him and say, oh, it reminds me of his great-great-grandfather that I was such a good buddy with. That's the chus avos, you know. Avram Holiness Yitzchak, the Pasuk says, Yitzchak looked just like Avram. Now she quotes the beginning of Parshas Tolda, Yitzchak had a very similar appearance to Avram. Because Baruch Hu loved Avram, so he loved Yitzchak. Not that Yitzchak didn't do his things on his own to deserve it, but because Baruch Hu loved Yitzchak, you know, he loved Avram. There's a similarity. After generations go by, the similarity isn't there. However, there is the concept of bris avos, that relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is permanent, the bris, the covenant, the deal. So that's what the what gives us the right to ask. This wasn't we're not approaching HaKadosh Baruch Hu as a friend. We can argue Thomas chus avos, but not bris avos. And therefore we ask him, oh, zacharta of bris, you didn't remember the bris, you didn't remember the covenant, you didn't remember the things which were promised and so on, and that's why we're allowed to ask that question. Just to give some examples, so it says in the Dalit stanza below, Zacharta deligas dilu derech, asher delagtu l'dralech, you didn't remember the kfitzas haderech, Rashi quotes in the beginning of last week's Sedra, in Dvorim, that an 11-day journey took them only 3 days, right? V'asor ashem al kanfei nesharim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or perhaps HaKadosh Baruch Hu's chisha v'shakeit, rush to Yitzis Mitzrayim before the time. That's the Deligas Diluk Derech. Didn't remember that. The Rebbe stands later in the Ches. Velo Zacharta Chitun Chukei Chorei. Chitun is the Chasana. The word for a wedding, the Chasana. You know, it says, Torah Tzivolana Moshe Morosha Kios Yaakov Al Tikr Morosha Ela Ma'orosha, says the Gemara Pesachim. Right? Our relation with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a marriage. It's a contractual relation. That took place at Chorei. The Chitun Zacharta Chitun Chorei. At Mamar Arsina was like a wedding. The ayin stands below Zacharta Adi Adayim Asher Itarta Lavadecha. Adi Adayim is jewels. It's the crowns, the keser that we received for Satuksar, the crowns that we received for saying Nasa Nishma. So in all of these things we're saying we have not just a friendship relation with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but a contractual relation, and therefore we have the right to say, how come we've forgotten all about this HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Echo has to be a prayer on the next kinah begins Adar Chuk Shamayim. Adar is an unusual word. It means that I could soar, would that I could soar up to the heavens. Adar Chuk Shamayim. The opening stanza mentions that which we spoke about last night, and I mentioned here again as well. Avchin b'vchi leil midbar, a reference to the weeping, the crying in that night in the midbar, which, in a certain sense, all of the tragedies that took place on Tisha B'Av and on other occasions, which are observed or thought about on Tisha B'Av, the concept will come back to later, but. Was all determined or a result of that one evening. I mentioned last night the kasha, which the Gemara asks, and the unusual answers the Gemara gives. Gemara asks, why in Tainis, how do we know that the Churban Bayis Sheni happened on the 9th of Av? The first Churban took place on the 9th of Av. We have Psukim that the Gemara produces to demonstrate that Psukim, the Tanakh was not yet completed. And the canon wasn't sealed, sort of, at the time of the Churban Bayis Rishon, so we have Psukim that speak about in the end of Malachim Beis and Yirmiyahu. The Psukim that speak about the Churban, so you can figure out from the Psukim when it happened. The Bayis Sheni, there's no more Psukim, there's no more Tanakh at the time of the of Bayis Sheni. So where do we have? So one would have expected, perhaps, that the Gemara would answer, "Well, there's a tradition. We have, the truth is, but the Gemara, and certainly the Mishnah." The Mishnah was compiled not that long after the Churban Bayis Rishon. I mean, we're talking about less than 200 years. So one could say we have a tradition; it's handed down from parent to child, and so on. That the Churban Bayis Sheni was also ninth of. That's not what the Gemara says. I'm sure there was such a tradition, but that's what the Gemara answered. The Gemara says Megalgulin Chov Al Yom Chayat. The Gemara says, well, there was a day of Peronos, so Mistomer. That's when it's almost like the Gemara saying, well, when else would it happen? It has to be on Tisha B'Av because the first person was destroyed on Tisha B'Av, and the Meragim was on Tisha B'Av. Again, it's an unusual answer, and it requires, I think, further analysis than we can do right now, but that's what the Gemara says. So, but perhaps the idea is that this day was determined as a day, and that's really the Lashon of the Rambam in Hilchos Panios. It says, Yom Muchon L'Puranios. It today, which was, you know, sort of fit or almost set aside or destined to be a day of Puranios. And so the first one, of course, is the Avchin Bivchi El Midbar. Somehow that event, that story with the Meraglim, is the, you know, is the event that somehow made this day, the day of Chorban, the day of destruction. And so later on in the Kina it says, Adva b'cholev l'hamtzi ehu. I mentioned to you in the Torah reading, so there is this concept of returning to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the concept of tshuva. In Slichas, we say a phrase, Himotze lonam v'akashosenu, be found. Right, that's the phrase here too, Adva b'cholev l'hamtzi ehu. Because the Pasuk says, Lena v'kashta misham esashon l'akecha u'motzosa. We search for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we'll find him. So now we say we're searching for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Actually, in that same standard, it says Edag Aye Roev Elohim Tzoeu. We're looking for those who were leading us, and we couldn't find them. That's the pasuk says in the Akonim Lo Amru Aye Hashem. Nobody could find HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They say from the Velvel Vishka, that's because the Gemara says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shechina was Golam and Makom and Makom. The Shechina jumped around, so to speak, as the Chorban process unfolded. It was difficult, so to speak, to find HaKadosh Baruch Hu in his usual place. Later on in the Kina, we have the phrase towards the end, Ayumasi b'chol shana omeres hi hashana hazos. Every year we say, this is the year. You know, it's frustrating. I remember as a child, I think I've related this in the past, and I don't know why it stands out in my head, but, you know, on Pesach night, we sing at the very end, those who are still awake, at the very end of the Seder, so we sing the song Adir Hu, right? Yivne Veso Vikaro, Vimehra, right? The HaKadosh Baruch Hu to rebuild Adir Hu and all the other letters of the Aleph Bey described by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Vimehra 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 Vikaro, Kael B'nei, B'nei Veso Vikaro. I remember I was a young boy, but somehow I remember my father once saying, we were singing Adir Hu, just almost like as a side comment, but somehow stuck with me. It was, how many generations of Jews have said this piyut every year on Pesach? Bimhera, bimhera, v'yameinu b'karov, kel b'nei, kel b'nei, b'nei eschav b'karov. Every year we say it, and so I don't know exactly when that particular piyut was written, but certainly for quite a long time, Jews have said, that's what it says here, b'chol shana omeres hi ha-shana hazos. Every year we think, this is the year, finally. Right, this is the year. We're going to go back to Yerushalayim, and this is going to be the year. And we've been frustrated over and over again. I think I've have related in the past the fact that, you know, we always say Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim. Why don't we say Lashana Hazos B'Yerushalayim? Why don't we say Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim? So one answer is what we mean is this time next year. Lashana Haba means that this time next year we should be in Yerushalayim. But one could also say Lashana Haba, depends how you accent the word Ba. Those of Bali Kriya know, you know, we say Vinei Rachel Ba'a Im Hatzon. She's now, it's in the present. Lashana Haba'ah, if you accent it the right way, it means the year that has come, this year, the present year. Maybe that's what we have in mind. But in any case, until now, we've been frustrated. So again, we ask the question. However, here, at the very end, HaKadosh Baruch Hu answers. You throw the last stanzas, and sort of a slap in the face, so to speak, but the answer. We ask Eicha, but there's an answer. Yisrael me'eis bidrocha lo'holoko. Azavuni v'azavti m'fonar v'hem ne'pachu. Right? And they haven't followed my ways. They have abandoned me. That too is from a theme mentioned in the Haftarah. We ask, Alma of the Oretz. Based on what was the, the land abandoned, so to speak? We've pointed out in past occasions that the Eretz Yisrael was an abandoned land really until the latter part of the 1800s. I think I've related to in the past that Mark Twain, the American writer, Mark Twain went on a trip around the world, and he sent in his experiences. It was published, I forgot, the Harper's Magazine, a Saturday Evening Review, some American magazine, I forgot which one. And so every place he went, he sent in a diary, so to speak, of what he saw traveling around the world. And his recollection of, or his relating of what he saw in Palestine, was an abandoned land, desolate, and nothing grows there. It's this, you know, this is like disappointed. That's the Holy Land. I mean, there are shrines and the temples and this and that, but he said in terms of the land itself, barren, desolate. So that's exactly, Amo of the Haaretz. You know, what happened? So the Kadosh Baruch Hu answers, Alozom is Torosi. That's what we say here as well. Unfortunately, there's an answer. And that again connects to the Tshuva theme, which comes up time and again. Adar Chuk Shamayim. Next, Kina begins, Echa Yoshua Havakelas HaSharon. This Kina, again, Rabbi Elazar Kalir, follows an alphabetical acrostic, the Aleph Beis, based on the opening parak of Megillat Echa. So each stanza here begins with another word, with the word, rather, that opens the corresponding pasuk in the first parak of the Megillah. Havakelas HaSharon, the rose of the Sharon, the Sharon Valley, the reference to Klal Yisrael, but in general, but this particular kina makes reference to the Chof Dalad Mishmeros Kahuna. The Gemara tells us that in the days of David HaMelech, and even before Shmuel HaNavi, so they set up a system where the Kohanim were divided into 24 families, 24 different groups. Obviously, as time goes on, you don't need every Kohen, not the case, that every Kohen served in the Beis HaMikdash every single day. You didn't need that many Kohanim. And basically, the setup was such that there were different shifts, different groups, and you were on when the week that your family was turned awry, and then even within the family, it was further divided up, you know, by smaller groups in the family, divided up the days of the week and so on. But the regalim, by the time the shalosh regalim, you needed all hands on deck, so he had all the Kohanim. But other than the time during the Golem, so he had these shifts, 24 different shifts. And the rest of the time, these Kohanim were the teachers of Klal Yisrael, and they lived in the cities. There were certain cities which are designated as Ori Halavim, as we know from the Torah. And what you have in this Kina is a reference to all of these cities. Most of these cities, I think, are in the Galil. These are cities in which the Kohanim lived. I don't know that we have, other than this kina, a record of many of these names. Some of these names do appear elsewhere, but somehow the Paitan here, Elazar Kalir, had perhaps sources that we don't have, where he had actually the names of the different cities, where they came from. So each stanza in this kina ends with the name of another city or another town where the Kohanim came from. And this kina mourns, so to speak, the loss of the Chof Dalet Mishmeros Kehuna, which of course ceased to have importance with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Now, one can ask, you know, why is it that a whole kina is dedicated to the, you know, to the Kohanim? So the answer may be on a couple of levels. First of all, in terms of the loss of personal kedusha and personal role, so the Kohanim lost more than anybody else, because although we still today have a mitzvah, the kedashto, there's still a mitzvah to honor a kohen, we give a kohen the first aliyah, the benching and so on, the rishus, but still, in terms of being those people who ran the Beis HaMikdash, the people who received truma, the other matnos kahuna, so that doesn't exist anymore. The full kedusha of the kohen doesn't exist in the same way as it did during the time of the Beis HaMikdash, and therefore the kohanim, who had the highest level of kedusha, lost the most, so to speak. So that's perhaps one reason for an entire kina on this you know, on this topic. And the other, of course, is that the Kohanim were the leaders of the Jewish people. Leaders, unfortunately, who failed sometimes, and therefore it's kind of like lamenting the failure of leadership on the part of the Kohanim. And finally, the idea is that the Kohanim were singled out. The Rav developed this point. Were singled out for poor treatment, especially by the Romans. Somehow the priests, they were the target of a great deal of persecution, a great deal of suffering was experienced by the Kohanim, and therefore in that regard the Paital, as a clear, dedicates this entire kina in their memory. Now, you have in a couple, in the Gimel stanza, it says, Bavon Maisus Ushmita, so we know that the Chazal tell us that the Chor, based on Pesukim in the Torah, really, again in Parshas Bahar, at the end of Chumash Vayikra, that Oz Kirtzar to Shav Susav, we don't observe the Shemitah properly and let the land lie fallow when we're supposed to, because Baruch Hu says he'll take care of things and make the land lie fallow when we're not there, we turn it out. So that's mentioned here, Bavon Maisus Ushmito. Later on in the Chofa stanza, it mentions the test stanza. It says, the Yodah Parastar says, Kichloya Chuyati Kidor Hamabul. Very strong statement. We really should have been totally eliminated, like the Dor Hamabul, nothing left. Right, and we deserve this kind of punishment to be obliterated like the Dor HaMabul was, which is quite a dramatic statement. And not only, of course, were the Kohanim themselves punished and the Kohanim themselves suffer, but that which they represented, it's discussed in the Pei and the Tzadi and the Kuf stanza, different things relating to the Beis Hamikdash, Bris Melach, that's the Karbonos, Shemen the Muach, the Shemen HaMishkah, Ner Adolik, Ramira, right? The menorah and the special light. All of this was dimmed at the time of the Chorban. This kina contributes to the 24 Mishmaros Kehuna. Echa Yoshua. The next kina begins. Vayikonen Yirmiyahu Yoshio, Echa Eli Konenu Me'elov. This is a kina in memory of the great King Yoshio. By way of the background information, for those not familiar, so Yoshiyahu was the king who, pioneered the Tshuva movement and was able to get the entire Klal Yisrael, for the most part, to repent and to return to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and it was sorely needed. Yoshiyahu had a grandfather who was named Menashe, who goes down certainly as one of the most terrible kings that we had, although at the end of his life he did tshuva, but the good part of his life, the early part of his life, Menashe dedicated himself to the eradication of Torah. He went ahead to popularize Avodah Zarah, and there were idols placed all over Eretz Yisrael, including in the Beis Hamikdash itself, and Torah was completely forgotten. Menashe's son ruled only for 2 years. He was killed by his own palace guards, but the next was the child Yoshiyahu. Now, it says, Ben Shmone Shona Heichel Lidrosh Melokov. He was a young boy, and he was only 8 years old when he started his reign, as Pasuk says in Malachim Beis, and he ended up being king for more than 30 years, but it was such a bad state that there were Jews in Eretz Yisrael, apparently, who never even knew what a Sefer Torah looked like, let alone what a Sefer Torah contained. And the Beis Hamikdash itself was in a state of disrepair, and under Yoshio's direction, the Kohanim began to do the repairs of the coin by the name of Chilkiyahu HaKohen, very possibly or likely the father of Yirmiyahu, Divrei Yirmiyahu ben Chilkiyahu min HaKohen HaShev HaNosos, says Chilkiyahu. This Chilkiyahu began to work on refurbishing the Beis Hamikdash, and he came across in the Beis Hamikdash a Torah, and the Torah was, they opened it up, and the Torah was in Tochacha and Dvarim, where it said, Orer asher lo yokim es divrei HaTorah zos lasos osam. Cursed is the person who doesn't observe the Torah. He brought this to the attention of Yoshiyahu, and Yoshiyahu was inspired by this to basically call the entire Jewish people together to get rid of all the idols and so on. And many people did. Unfortunately, many people didn't. Yoshua was somewhat naive, but he sent out soldiers to see to it that everybody had gotten rid of their Avodah Zarah. The people had clever ways to hide them and to outwit the soldiers who came to check. But in any event, nonetheless, there was a tremendous movement under Yoshiyahu. Yoshiyahu died under unfortunate circumstance. He had a little too much confidence in his own success. And when the Egyptian ruler wished to simply pass through Eretz Yisrael, he didn't allow it. The Pasuk says, after all, the Cherev lo savor ba'artzachem, it would be the mitzvah, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu will see to it that no army goes through your land, even if they're just coming through not to attack you, they're just on their route to somebody else, you know, no one's going to come through. And Yoshio felt that when we've done tshuva, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu was not going to allow this to happen, he didn't allow the king of Egypt, Paro Necho, his name, to come in. And then, unfortunately, the king attacked, for having been denied the rule, the right to pass through. Here, Yoshio did not heed the directive of Yirmiyahu, who told him to let Paro pass through with his troops. Yoshio did not, and thought that the Jewish people had reached the level that Kadosh Baruch Hu will protect them from any enemy, even the enemy just trying to come in. This was an error, and Yoshio himself died. He went out to battle with this Paro, and Yoshio was killed in that battle. Why a kina about Yoshio, the individual? So again, he was a great man, no doubt. Pasuk says, the kina says in the opening stanza, Lo kam kamohu mimos Avigdor. There's nobody like him since Avigdor. Who's Avigdor? Avigdor is Moshe Rabbeinu. The Medrash says there are a number of different names for which Moshe Rabbeinu is known, and one of them is Avigdor. So here it says, there was nobody like him, nobody like Moshe until the days of Yoshio. So that's certainly one reason to have a kina. There's something else as well. We'll come up with this theme again perhaps later on. I spoke about the loss of dignity to the Jewish people, but the truth of the matter is, when we recite kinos and we focus, as we should, on the public or communal tragedy which befell us on Tisha B'Av, we should not lose sight of the individual tragedies as well. Regular human beings, people suffer. We sometimes tend, especially as time goes on, until we're looking back at the event of something that happened so many centuries ago, so we look at it as a communal disaster for the Jewish people, which of course it was. But we tend to lose sight that what you had were real, regular people, men, women, children, who suffered at the hands of whether it was the Babylonians, the Bayis Rishon, the Romans, the Bayis Sheni. People starved, people died, people underwent tremendous personal suffering as well. So we shouldn't lose sight of that. So this kina reminds us that this was a leader of the Jewish people, but still an individual met a terrible end. He was pierced by arrows, during this battle, and ultimately realized that he had made a mistake by ignoring the directive of Yirmiyahu. But in any event, he was a human being, and sometimes. Again, when we mourn a national tragedy, we lose sight of the suffering of the individual. The Gemara tells us in Gittin, Rabbi Yochanan and Zakkai, we may come back to this perhaps another time as well, Rabbi Yochanan and Zakkai, when he made the deal with the Roman general Vespasian, soon to be Emperor Vespasian, that ultimately he forfeited Yerushalayim, quite a cataclysmic decision. But he forfeited Yerushalayim, but he said, Tainli Yavne v'chachameo, but he still maintained the Jewish leadership, Torah leadership. They moved to Yavna and so on. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, when he struck this deal, he was granted three requests by the Roman emperor, just become the emperor, as per his prophecy, so to speak. So he said the thing what he wanted was, Tainli Yavna v'chachameh, we'll forfeit Yerushalayim, but we want to be able to reconstitute Jewish life in Yavna, which of course he did. He also asked that the family of Rabbi Gamliel, the Nasiim, be spared. And then he asked for a doctor to treat Rabbi Tzaddok. Rabbi Tzaddok was a Tana, Rabbi Tzaddok was someone who fasted once he realized that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, he fasted for many, many years, every day, in tefillah, in hope that the Beis HaMikdash would not be destroyed. And he became emaciated and sickly because of it. And if war was going on, the Romans weren't that interested in one, skinny, sickly Jew. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, when he spoke to the emperor of Vespasian, asked for a doctor to help treat from Tzadok and revive him, so to speak. And people wonder, here you are at a crossroads, a moment of truth in Jewish history. You know, what are you going to ask for? So we understand, you know, the Torah sent us, removed to Yavne. The family of the Nesiim, Rabbi Gamliel, should be allowed to continue, and they should be saved. But the doctor, with all due respect to Tzadok, was this such a major thing? That had to be one of the things he asked for at that important moment, at that transition moment. Which again, Rav and others have pointed out, yes, you don't lose sight of the suffering of the individual. Even when we focus on the community and the communal tragedy, we must bear in mind as well the personal suffering, the personal tragedy as well. The next kina begins. Oli asher ta'avta ad lo vereishis, and the phrase that ends each stanza concludes with the word po. First of all, in terms of oli asher ta'avta ad lo vereishis, is the opening phrase. Chazal tell us that a number of things were created by HaKadosh Baruch Hu before he created the world. And one of them is the Beis HaMikdash. So that's the reference here, is Ali Asher Ta'avta Ad Lo Bereishis. Even before Bereishis, even before creation, there was the vision that there would be a Beis HaMikdash. But we end each stanza, as I said before, with the phrase, or the word Po. What is the word po? Po means here, in this place. And the reference is, as Soloveitchik explained, to the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu decided to place his Shekhinah in this world. Po, here in this world. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Shemei HaShemayim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is all over. Shlomo HaMelech said, we built the Beis HaMikdash, that the heavens don't contain HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? Shemei HaShemayim HaKal Kalucha, Avke HaBayis, this Beis HaMikdash is going to be a place where HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Shekhinah is found. How is it possible? HaKadosh Baruch Hu can't be contained by anything, not even the vast heavens, the vast universe. How is it going to happen in this house? So there's the concept of Tzimtzum, which is, I'm not going to go into detail about it now. HaKadosh Baruch Hu somehow, yes, he concentrates his Shekhinah to be in this place, to be Po, to be in the Beis HaMikdash. And, of course, HaKadosh Baruch Hu left the Beis HaMikdash, he's not there anymore. That's the idea each time in each stanza about Tom Malifo. These are all psukim that end with the word po. But again, the idea is that this is the place where HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to be. HaKadosh Baruch Hu did constrict his Shekhinah, so to speak, his presence, in order to be able to be there. And of course, now he's not there. The kina ends. Again, on a positive note, refuah seed the tucho, that eventually will be healed. Ki rega biapok, and the Kadosh Baruch Hu's anger is not permanent. Kadosh Baruch Hu's eventually forgives. His anger is only limited. Ki rega biapok, like we say in the pasuk in the same davening, ki rega biapok, and so on, pasuk in Tillim. So Kadosh Baruch Hu's anger really is only for one moment on a certain level. And so eventually there'll be there'll be this geula, but still, we end. It's going to end. The ad ator echo yaiv bapo. Okay. Still, I wonder how Kadosh Baruch Hu has clouded me until now in his anger. Echo yaiv bapo. Yaiv from the word cloud. Av onan. It's a cloud. So this is the idea that Kadosh Baruch Hu is not visible. In the Beis HaMikdash, Kadosh Baruch Hu's presence, so to speak, was seen. Was at least experienced. Was palpable. The absence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the Beis HaMikdash, so there's a sense of Ya'iv, you know, in the Ya'iv Da'apo. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is hidden, he's behind a cloud, he's not perceived, he's veiled. We can't see him, we can't find him, we can't see him in the same sense as we did when the Beis HaMikdash was built. So although we have that positive ending, Refuah Seed Betucha, that our healing and our recovery is certain, nonetheless, at this point, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is still completely hidden from us, as though behind a cloud. All the Ashton. Next kino, Echo, again a play on the word Echo. Echo divided into two words is Echo, which means where is the Ko? What this kino does is it takes psukim from the Torah, and which relates to different people who were recipients of haftochas, of promises for good, introduced or including the word ko. So, for example, in the opening stanza, it says, "Bevristan Absarim ko yeh lanetzach." Avram was told, "Ko yeh zaracha." So the what happened to that ko is basically asking, "A ko, where is that ko that was sent to Avram? Lo malokim zanach lanetzach." So why, Kadosh Baruch Hu, made that haftocha that all these disasters happened? Each stanza is a reference to somebody else where the word ko played a role. For example, in the second stanza regarding Yitzchak, it says Nelcha ad ko by the Akeda, or by Yaakov Avinu, worked for Lavan, so he had the incidents where he was able to acquire Lavan's wealth through this trick he did with the sheep. It says ko, ko yomar nekudin, akudin yes harecha, and so on. Moshe Rabbeinu, early in his career, when he killed the Mitzri, and it says vayifin ko vacho. So on and on, each time we have different people who promised bracha that some positive thing happened with the word ko, including the Jewish people in general. For example, in the later standard says, Eko siach shishim osios haknumos, 60 letter bracha, that's Birchas Kohanim. Birchas Kohanim, Recha Hashem Yishmerecha, etc., begins with the phrase, Ko sivorcho es b'nei Yisrael. And of course, you have Matan Torah itself, Ko soma leves Yaakov. Each time, again, what happened to this Ko? But I want to mention something else regarding the word Ko. To contrast it, if you will, with the word po that appeared in the previous stanza, not just because they rhyme. The fact is that po implies something specific. It's here, in front of us, that's where it is. And it's evident, it's there, and that's what we spoke about in the last kina, because Baruch Hu's Shekhinah was evident. However, the word ko has an implication of something beyond, of seeing something beyond that which is visible. Was what Avram told his servants at the time of the Akedah. According to the Medrash, so it was Eliezer and Yishmael with him. And the Medrash says that when they approached the mountain where the Akedah would take place, which of course in our tradition is the Makom HaMikdash, Har Moriah. So the question was, he asked, what do you see? He asked Eliezer and Yishmael, according to the Medrash, what do you see here? And they responded, "On the mountain, there's a lot of mountains around there. Nothing stood out." When he asked Yitzchak what he saw, he said he saw some sort of a cloud on top of the mountain, a symbol of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence. And that's when Avraham Avinu told them, "Listen, you wait here. Shulachem po imachamor. You guys will stay here. You don't see anything special here. You're not in tune with what's happening here." So he told them, "Shulachem po imachamor. You stay here with the donkey, but vaniva nar." Nelchad Ko. Me and the young men, son Yitzchak, we're going to go ad Ko. So in that sense, the word Ko represents something beyond that which is evidence. From the point of view of perception, reality for Eliezer and Yishmael, what did they see? They saw a mountain. A mountain looked like any other mountain. But obviously there was something special here which they missed. They weren't in tune with it. Again, it's not necessarily a criticism of them, but they did not see that which Avram and Yitzchak saw. So in that sense, the word ko is a promise of something beyond, that has significance beyond that which is readily perceptible in the here and now. And perhaps, again, at least al derech ha-drush, that's why so many haftachos begin with ko amar Hashem, that there's something beyond the obvious here. There's something beyond. Berachas Kohanim is not just these psukim, each one of these words, each one of the letters has significance, goes beyond that which is understood on a physical level. Matan Torah, Kosama Beis Yaakov. So needless to say, it's well beyond that which is perceptible in terms of the simple senses. And so here, we lament the A-Ko, what happened to all these Ko's, what happened to everything which is supposed to be beyond that which is readily perceptible that we understood at one time. However, on the positive note, again, we end, because it also says, Ko Amar Hashem Shavti L'Yerushalayim Barachamim Beisi Yibona Od, a promise that will be restored to that Ko, and will again, once again, be able to perceive HaKadosh Baruch Hu beyond that which is perceptible to the regular five senses. Eko. The next kinnah begins, Echa Es Asher Kar Asuhu, mentions that from the very beginning, it was clear that the Beis HaMikdash was eventually going to be destroyed. The Medrash tells us that at the very opening of the history of the world, HaKadosh Baruch Hu foretold the Beis HaMikdash, but also foretold or foresaw and understood that it was going to be destroyed. Bonui v'chorev u'bonui v'achariz. Built and destroyed and built. In fact, the Medrash has Bereshis Bara, so that's Bonui, v'aratos osovavo, it's chorev v'ma Hashem yi'or, that's Bonui. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was destined that the Beis HaMikdash would be destroyed. I don't know if Tisha B'Av is destined as the date at that time, although again, I mentioned that the Rambam has the Lashon about this day being Yom Muchon L'Puranios. It's a day set aside for Puranios, so it was already an early stage. There's a reference in an early stanza here to that which, in the Dalet stanza, to this declaration of Adam HaRishon, where it says, Ayeka, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu called out to Adam HaRishon, rather, Ayeka. Ayeka, of course, is the same letters as Echa. There's no vowels that are found in the Torah, in the actual Torah scroll, in the sacred Torah itself. There are no vowels. So the word Ayeka, which is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Adam HaRishon at the time of the original Chet, eating from the Eitz Hadas, so there's a kind of a play on words here. Reference to Adam HaRishon and the very first chait. Here, the idea might seem to be that, unfortunately, chait is built in, so to speak, to the human condition. And as such, there's going to be punishment, there's accountability. And one can ask why this is so, why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu create in that fashion? The answer is in order to give man Bechira Chofshes, which is a fundamental principle in terms of our system of belief. If everything always worked out perfectly and, there'd be no Bechira Chofshes. Sometimes people have to be allowed to make mistakes. And so this kinna allows for the fact, or promotes the fact, that Adam HaRishon himself made this terrible error, which of course resulted in the very first Golos in history, Adam HaRishon being driven out of Gan Eden and into other places out of Gan Eden. So that's the very first Golos. So in a certain sense, Tisha B'Av connects to that very first Aveira that mankind was involved in at the very beginning of our history. Now, the truth is, the Kinnah mentions later, which just stands up towards the end, it says, in the Ashin stanza, it says, Umei pros kroveimo dokrim. The waters of the Euphrates sort of pierced the people's insides. What does this mean? So there is a medrash that says that more Jews died because of drinking the water from Mei pros, the Euphrates River, when they came to Babel, than had been killed by Nebuchadnezzar. Apparently, they were not, the systems were not, water is different in different parts of the world. We know that today. You know, it used to be a bigger issue before processing plants and so on and so forth. But, you know, people know when they toured other countries, you know, you don't drink the water, right? They used to say the certain countries shouldn't drink the water. Now, what do you mean? The people there drink the water. So, the answer is because if your stomach and your system is used to water in one sense, so you drink a different type of water that may have a different chemical content and so on. So the people who grow up on it, so they're used to it, so they can do it. But it can cause others to be ill. And I think still today, when you go and eat certain types of foods in other countries, it's not healthy. It can cause some problems. It's one of the reasons why they don't like you to bring in. You know, when you come back on a plane, they have you fill out a little paper testifying you're not bringing any fruits or food into the United States. The customs makes it sign that. So that's because, again, certain fruits or certain things can cause people to become ill. So here, apparently, the water of the Euphrates was a different quality of water than the Jews had been used to in Eretz Yisrael. And so when they drank from that, it caused a tremendous stomach problems and digestive problems, and many people died as a result. That's the Me Pros Provemo Dokrin. That is a side, sort of a side tragedy of Golos, right? And I would extrapolate from here, not just in the physical sense of not being accustomed to the water of the land, but also in the social and I guess the spiritual sense as well. You come to another country and you feel like you're not part of things, you don't know what's going on, you're not used to these mores, you're not used to this culture. Now that too is a notion of galus. Mm-hmm. But in any event, as we mentioned before, the very first chait resulted in galus. And that's the Ayeka, the original Echa, spelled, pronounced when we read it, Ayeka. And that's one of the things which is alluded to here in this kina, when it was known by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as it was known by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that eventually the Beis HaMikdash would be destroyed, but built again. Again, that Haftach is still there. It's Bonoi V'Chorei U'Vonoi. Echa is Asher Korei Su. The next kina, which begins with the words Echa Shposo Pasuach Kikever, is a very, very long kina because it is based, as we'll see in a second, it's really based on all the prakim and Echa. But the longest, in terms of number of psukim, the longest parak in Echa is the third parak, because the third parak has three psukim for each letter of the aleph base. There's three, first three psukim, the parak gimel of Echa, the aleph, the next three psukim of the base, the next three psukim of gimel, etc. So here, at the end of each phrase, you have, in this kina, at the end of each phrase, you have the words from that third parak of Megillas Echa, the opening phrase of each of those three psukim. So the beginning, for example, each line, the first line ends on Yagever, the second Osinog, and the third Achmi Yashuv Yacho. Those are psukim, the first three psukim of parak Gimel Megillas Echa. The beginning of each phrase begins with the, or each stanza rather, begins with the corresponding psukim of the first, second, and fourth parak. First, second, and fourth parak are also alphabetical. Aleph base. Again, you'll have the stanza, you can see it inside. The first line of the stanza begins with Echa, because that's the first word of Parak Aleph of the Megillah, and that line ends with the first Aleph Pasuk of Parak Gimel. Second line begins, again, Echa, that's the first word of the second Parak of Megillah, that line ends with the second Aleph Pasuk of Parak Gimel. The third line of the stanza begins, again, the word Echa, which is the beginning of the fourth parak, the first word of the fourth parak, and ends Achbi Yashuv Yachoch, which is the third Aleph stanza. And then, finally, the fourth stanza here begins with the word beginning the corresponding pasuk in the final chapter of Megillas Echa. Now, the fifth chapter of Megillas Echa does not follow the Aleph Beis. Nonetheless, it has 22 psukim. It follows, it's the number of psukim the same. Parak Hay of Megillas Echa has 22 psukim, not following the Aleph Beis, so that's Zechor, which is in the fourth stanza. And then, the end of that is no longer any psukim par gimel, you've used them up, there are only three psukim per letter in par gimel. What we have now is from the Tochacha in Parshas Bechukosai. We have various promises of disaster, so the opening stanza ends, Ve'veis Alechem Chorev, that's a pasuk from Parshas, that's from, you know, from Parshas Bechukosai. And the next stanza, in Bezos, Alati Melchem, so on and so forth, these are all psukim from Parshas Bechukosai. It's a very complex piyut, but it's long because it kind of weaves together all the psukim from the psukim from Prakim Aleph, Beis, Dalad, and Hay, and the stanza ends with the psukim from Gimel, and then the last stanza, with the last part of the stanza with the pasuk from Bechukosai. So it's a kind of intricate type of piyut. We'll just add that
The Ramban demonstrates in Chumash that all of the punishments that were foretold in Parshas Vayikra all came true. They were not just some things which all came true, and perhaps more so than any other time, at the time of the Churban and the disasters which befell the Jewish people at that time. That's why it's appropriate to weave that, those psukim, in as well. So again, this is one of the longest kinnos because of this intricate arrangement. The next kinna, Zechor Asher Oso Tzar B'Finim, refers to the event where Titus, the Roman general Titus, son of Vespasian, came into the Kodesh HaKadoshim and, in effect, challenged, as it were, HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. The Roman general came in and, in effect, announced that he's fighting not only against the Jewish people, but against the Jewish God as well. And so he went ahead to bring his sword into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and he stabbed the Parochas, in effect. The Gider Parochas Balash Teifonim. He paled the two-sided curtain in the Parochas. And in effect, to show that he is, of course, wrong, and defeating HaKadosh Baruch Hu. One can consult even non-Jewish historians to know how important the victory over the Jewish people was to the Romans. They devoted a tremendous amount of attention to defeating the Jews. Even when it was over, they had the four different generals besieging Jerusalem, and many people are familiar with the section of the Arch of Titus, which has the symbol of the Jews being led into exile, etched into it or carved into it, carrying the menorah away, the famous piece. People are familiar as well that the Romans minted a special coin, a commemorative coin. We still have that practice today. People have commemorative coins. So that goes back to ancient times. The Romans minted a commemorative coin which said on it the words Judea Capta, which means that the Judah, Yehuda, the Jewish people, have been captured. And on the coin, there's a picture, I'm sure you've all seen, I can't imagine that many people haven't seen a picture of that coin, but there's a Roman soldier on the coin standing proud, and on the other side, a Jew, next to him, a Jew is sitting under a tree weeping in destruction. So there was an Indian here, not only a military victory, but almost an obsession with defeating not only the Jews, but showing that they defeated God as well. And here the pattern of the kinna comes from, again, the psukim of the fifth chapter of Megillas Eicha. So it starts with Zechor and Nachlasenu and so on. So again, there's 22 words, even though it's not in the order of the Aleph Beis here. A number of comments about the some lines in the kinna itself. It says, "Alomotza tishim mishlosha klei shoris." You know, there were 93 different vessels. Somehow the Romans were intrigued. Soloveitchik writes, and I'll read him, in his words from again the book, "The Lord Writes in All His Ways." What was so attractive about the vessels? By the way, we know from the Bais Rishon also. This kind of talking about Titus and the Romans. The Bais Rishon too. Many people recall that in the opening parak of Megillas Esther, when we read about the party of Ahasuerus, there's one phrase, it says, V'chelim mikelim shonim, that we have the tradition to read that phrase in the tune of Megillas Eichon Purim, just that phrase, a couple other places in Megillah too, but in that section, just that phrase, V'chelim mikelim shonim, because Ahasuerus, when he made his party, according to our tradition, used the vessels from the Beis HaMikdash. And anyway, so the Rav says, the sacred vessels were a precious treasure even for these pagan kings who greatly appreciated them. What was so attractive about the vessels that they brought them from Jerusalem to Persia, to Shushan, and to any other city? Why did the vessels capture the fancy of Ahasuerus, and Belshazzar, and Nebuchadnezzar? Why were they interested in having the vessels in their possession? The Gemara says that Titus cut the parochas in two parts. The Python here, this kinna that we're talking about now, says that he actually attacked all the sacred vessels. What did Titus find that attracted his attention and intrigued him? Something in the Jew intrigues the Gentile. This is the Rav's own words. In itself, this is not a bad quality. It may be the Torah, it may be Shabbos. The Romans and the Greeks could not understand what Shabbos is all about. Why let animals rest on Shabbos? Why not work them 7 days a week? And they could not understand the idea of the Holy of Holies. Is anyone there? No, only the Shekhinah. And what the Shekhinah is, they did not understand. They did not simply reject the Torah. They were intrigued by it and wondered about it. And somehow, something was, as the Rav says, something that was attractive to the Goyim, that they wanted to not only, again, wage a normal military battle, but so to speak, attack HaKadosh Baruch Hu as well, and were proud of what they thought that they'd accomplished. It's interesting, in this kinnah, it mentions the phrase, Behu Asur Bazikim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, so to speak, was tied up in chains. That's also an important theme. I mentioned earlier about the dignity of Klal Yisrael connected to the dignity of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So we know about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it says, Imo Anochi Mitzara. Imo Anochi Mitzara. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was with us in times of need. And the pasuk in the beginning of Sefer Yechezkel, the Maaseh Merkava, which describes, among other things, the movement of HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shekhinah, Eretz Yisrael, so to speak, into Golus, that has there the expression, Vehu Asur Bazikin. In fact, there's some comment that the phrase that we say as part of the Hoshanas on Sukkot, Ani Vaho Hoshiana, Ani Vaho Hoshiana, that expression, what's Vaho? That's Vehu Asur Bazikin, representing HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Golos. That's the Vehu and the Ani, perhaps, in the Imanofi B'tzara. In any event, that's the phrase here, Vehu Asur Bazikin. What's also interesting is we do find the statement, Al Tzad Ma'arovi L'Zecher Hisrid Bo. One remnant was left on the western side, and that, of course, is the coast of Hamaravi, which obviously is the last remnant of the Beis HaMikdash, which, of course, is still there today. That's referred to in this kina as well. And towards the end of the kina, a theme which is mentioned later as well, that even the children, even youngsters, fought back and eventually gave their lives. It says, Kelecha Ragnum and Suos Yom, and Ron Gittin, that Jewish young men and women killed themselves rather than taken away into slavery. That's alluded to here, but that's developed later on again. But the main part of this theme is the actions of Titus. And of course, it's striking because it adds insult to injury. Because a regular Jew is not permitted to the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Even a Kohen not permitted to Kodesh HaKadoshim. Just a Kohen Gadol on Yom HaKippurim. And here, he came in, so to speak, with impunity. Zechora Asher Oso Tzar Bifini. For the next keynote begins, in Tochan Anoshim Piryam Olei Tibuchim Alalai Li, is really a description of sort of a horrible event that individuals were subjected to. I mentioned before that we not only lament the national tragedy, but we don't lose sight of the individual suffering as well. And each stanza here ends with the phrase, Alalai Li, a woe unto me, or alas unto me, just it was almost like a shrieking type of kina of all the terrible things that happened. And it doesn't leave much to the imagination, really, beginning in Tochal Noshim Piryam Alalai Li, frightening what people went through. It's interesting, it says, in Togozna, and Gimel, it's followed the Aleph Beis, it says, in Togozna pas roshon v'sikshana l'susim porchim. It could happen that the locks of their hair were torn from their heads and they were tied by their hair to fleet horses. So this is a reference. This is a reference to something we find in the Medrash Eicha, that Miriam Bas Baisos, who was the wife of Yeshua ben Gamla, the Kohen Gadol, was tied by her hair to the tail of a horse, which was dragged from Yerushalayim to all the way to Lud. Even if there's a distance and exaggeration, the story is not. It's a horrible description of something that was done simply to torture people. Rav Soloveitchik points out in a chilling comment, again in the book Lord's Righteous in Those Ways, I read, we find others in the kinah beginning in Tochan Noshim Piram Arkinah, Rav Elazar Kali refers there to the story that the Medrash tells about Martha Bas Baisus. She was tied to the tail of a horse and was killed when the horse began to run. They used to bind women to the tail of a horse and then drive the horse at maximum speed. And here's what the Rav said. This also happened during the Holocaust in Poland and Lithuania. I shouldn't think that these events that happened, you know, so many years ago. Incidents occurred then that are identical with the acts described here. They did not happen only 1900 years ago. They happen now in our own time. Now the Rav records a personal... This happened to a first cousin of mine by the name of Yeshaya. His mother was a daughter of Reb Chaim Brisker. Reb Chaim had one daughter. You know, the sons are famous. He had a daughter as well. Reb Chaim's son-in-law was Reb Hirsch Glickson and Adam Gottel, a great man. His son, the grandson, was a little bit younger than I am. I knew him very well. He was not only a tzaddik, but a gaon olam. When the Nazis conquered Warsaw, they found him and his wife during the first week after their wedding. They tied his wife down to one car, and they tied him down to another car, and drove off at the speed of 70 miles per hour. And of course, the Rav doesn't finish the statement, it's obvious what happened. So here's the Rav recalling a personal event that happened to his cousin, someone whom he knew. Furthermore, shortly after this passage, the author of the Kinner writes how in the time of Churban, they used to swing a baby by his legs and crush his skull against the wall, and the brain substance used to drip on the stones. He's saying the Al Naras Baba, Ashrei Sheyochas and Ipe Tzalaycha saw it, so they did to us. This too happened under the Nazi regime. That was their method of killing babies, swinging them against their hard wall until their skulls were crushed. They enjoyed this very much. Whatever happened here, whatever we are told about the Churban Beis Hamikdash happened and was done with more cruelty and in greater magnitude numerically in Europe and in Western countries by the Nazis. There is not a single detail that Elazar Kalir records from rabbinic sources that was not true during our lifetime, the 1940s, in Lithuania, Russia, Poland, Hungary, and Romania. Now, Kalir also notes in his kina that the desire to kill children is more pronounced than the desire to kill adults. They first killed the children and then the intellectuals. Intellectuals they killed not only among Jews, but among all the nations. But killing the children was a special privilege bestowed upon the Jewish people alone. It was a psychopathic desire to kill the children. From the viewpoint of the psychopath, this kind of killing is more satisfying to a psychopathic urge because in the children, they see the future of the people and they want to destroy that future. Once you kill the children, there is no future. This was also the case during the Holocaust. The children were taken away immediately, even before the ghettos were liquidated. By the time the adults were sent off to Treblinka, Auschwitz, and Buchenwald, there were not many children left. The children were already exterminated by the time they started to liquidate middle-aged and elderly people. I would say a kind of chilling report. The Rav tells us that this kina, what's described here, was not something that, again, happened in the very, very distant past, but something which was in the relatively close past. And again, so the Rav experienced it personally. We're a generation or two later, but still not that far removed from this type of tragedy. We don't, it's interesting, I mean, we've heard in... Not to thank God the Jews as victims, but we hear from time to time in news of atrocities in Africa and other places that are perpetrated against other human beings, whether it's chopping up children or chopping arms off and so on. So we know that this can exist. We've been spared that kind of treatment for the most part, Baruch Hashem, now. Although, again, I'm reminded of, I thought of it this past, earlier in the summer, I had the privilege to be in Eretz Yisrael. So we were driving someplace and, you know, the road to Ramallah. So I can't pass that road, you know, without thinking, you know, don't make a wrong turn here. People remember two Israeli soldiers who were mistakenly, ended up in Ramallah, made a wrong turn, a simple wrong turn, and they were basically beaten to death and trampled to death, you know, and the blood was spilled out the window and so on, and one of the more vicious types of conduct that was perpetrated against us, and this is now... not even 50 and 60 years ago, but within the last couple of years. So, sadly, the type of personal suffering and torture and inhumane behavior which the Jewish people were victimized by during the Holocaust, during the Churban, happened again, and perhaps that gives a different spin on this particular kina. In Tochanu. The next kina really is a response to a certain sense, where actually continues the taina, which eventually results in a response. The previous kina ended, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds, listen, you know, you're telling all these terrible things that happened to you, right, but you don't say what you did. Now, that's an important point because it's going to lead us to the end of this kinnah. This kinnah begins again with a taina, v'ata amarta heitei veiti v'imoch, right? And therefore, yes, he promises good things over lama, bad things. Why did bad things happen? That's how each stanza begins. Ata, you said this, you did that, you promised things and delivered certain things, but then at the end, you didn't keep it. And why is that? And that's what most of this kinnah is about. However, at the very end, which leads into the kinnah that follows, it says we recognize that in fact that we deserve this. That's the previous kinnah ended with HaKadosh Baruch Hu said you're publicizing so much what happened to you, but you're not publicizing at all that which you did. And that this will begin a shift, at least in these kinnahs, to an understanding that in fact HaKadosh Baruch Hu is, of course, is righteous in all his ways. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is just, and we're deserving of it. Nonetheless, again, we say Eicha, as Yirmiyahu did, and we ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so still in this kinnah, most of this kinnah, is still, so to speak, this type of taina, v'ata amarta, you said this, or did so many wonderful things, but now why have you taken all of that away? And again, the answer comes in at the very end of the kinnah, Kichol zos bo'asnu b'chova. All of this has come to us because we're deserving of it. V'ata amarta heitei veiti v'imoch. Now the next kino begins the word Atel Kayas Necho Shma, or actually each line begins, it says each stanza has Atel Kayas Necho, bend your ear or turn your ear, and then Shma and listen. Again, based on the pasuk from Sefer Daniel, which is the same psukim that speak about Lecho Hashem Atzdoka. So after saying Lecho Hashem Atzdoka, Velona Bosh Haponim, again I stress, not just the Bosh Haponim back then, because Baruch Hu having done so many miracles, and then we don't really deserve it, but stressing that we ourselves, that we recognize ourselves because whatever has happened to a door that the Beis Hamikdash wasn't rebuilt in, so it's as though it was destroyed. Now we ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to turn into, now that we're in the tshuva process, so to speak, having recognized the righteousness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and our own fault, now he asks HaKadosh Baruch Hu to turn and look again at the suffering that we undergo. And it's one thing in the earlier kinnahs to have complained and to said why do all these terrible things happen and why do we suffer and so on, having admitted a certain sense of guilt, and again the guilt to this day because it's the Resha Shinin Tzavonu. So now he asks HaKadosh Baruch Hu to look again at the suffering with a different eye. Now we're not complaining. We're asking for HaKadosh Baruch Hu's blessing, so to speak, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to turn himself and to change his mind, so to speak. The routine also is similar to that which we read in the Mincha, laying in Mincha on Tisha B'Av, as on other fast days, namely the routine of Lama Yomru Mitzrayim, right? After all, people are going to see that the Jewish people are destroyed. So they're going to say two things. Number one, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't have the strength to prevent it. And number two, or alternatively, HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't really care about the Jewish people. And both of these things are, of course, not true. And again, this ties in with the dignity of HaKadosh Baruch Hu being related to the dignity of Klal Yisrael. So we ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu in this kin, especially at the end, a very powerful phrase, U'shma b'chiyas maspidim v'korim v'mechakim mosa yibaneh. Right, that's the refrain of Jewish history I mentioned earlier with Adirhu. But here, Mosai Yibane, when's it going to be rebuilt? We ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to turn and to listen. And that really completes this section of Kinos, having to do with the Churban. Now it comes back later as well, but right now we have recognized that despite our anguish and suffering, there's a reason behind it, there's a process of tshuva. And we ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to answer us when we say Mosa Yibaneh, we're waiting. I stress it says Mechakim Mosa Yibaneh.
You know, it's interesting that the Rambam's formulation of awaiting the Mashiach, it doesn't say just we have to believe in Mashiach, we have to await the Mashiach. It has to be part of our, it's not just to believe it'll come sometime, but we have to be mitzapeh. The Gemara says in Shabbos that one of the questions that everybody's asked after his period of time on this earth is, Tzipisul Yeshua, did you look forward to it? Did you think about it? Did you anticipate it? So it's not just enough to believe in some vague way that there's such a thing as the Mashiach, but there's a chakelo b'chol yom shev. I have to, you know, await it. It's something that, you know, has to be part of my, you know, part of my daily thinking. It's here. I have to await it. It's something I'm longing for, not just in a vague sense. That perhaps also hinted by this phrase, mechakim, not just that we, you know, we look forward to it, but mechakim, we're anticipating it. We're waiting to hear Moshe Yibane. Hatei lohez. The next kina, Arzi Alavano, certainly one of the more famous of the kinos. This is the kina relating to the Asara Haruge Malchus. There have been a number of different piyutim and kinos and slichos written about the Asara Malchus. We say a different, actually a more detailed version on Yom Kippur. The story of Asara Haruge Malchus, this is one of the kinos. There's actually a sefer published, somebody a couple of years ago wrote a sefer from Moshe Rav Kook, published something a couple of years ago on the Asara Haruge Malchus. There are many different versions. The story is kind of shrouded in a certain amount of mystery in the sense that clearly, and there are different lists, by the way, it's not at all clear who is to be numbered. Some are more obvious than others, not clear who's exactly to be numbered among the Asara Malchus. We have Midrashim, the description of Chazal, but they're not all consistent as to as exactly who they were. Clearly, relatively clearly, the Asara Malchus did not all live at the same time. So the story depicted not so much in this kina, but in the kina of the Yom Kippur, which speaks about some unnamed Roman leader summoning Jews together and putting shoes in a room, the connection to Yosef, and saying that you know, your great-great-great ancestor Yosef was sold by his 10 brothers. What should happen to what should have happened to them, and so on, and what happens when you kidnap somebody? He says, "Mos yumas donev nefesh misol, mos yumas." And so they said, well, he said, they were never punished, I'm taking you 10. So that would seem to be for dramatic effect, because they say, Lemaisa, the Asara Haruge Malchus did not all live at the same time. One thing is clear, Jewish scholars were tortured to death by the Roman authorities. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, who was a Nasi, there's more than Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, there's Rabbi Gamliel HaZokain, and his son of Shimon Gamliel was known as Shimon HaNerag. He was executed. In fact, these are stories in the Gemaras about that having happened. Shimon Gamliel, he lived before Bekiva. Bekiva, we also know, was tortured. They did not overlap. They did not live in the same time. So the depiction is for dramatic effect. But that Jewish leaders were tortured to death by the Romans, this is clear. And it appears also from the sources that Shimon Gamliel and Rabbi Shmuel Kohen Gadol, that's not the Rabbi Shmuel who was the Bar Plukta of Rabbi Akiva, but an earlier Rabbi Shmuel, perhaps his grandfather, those are the two that were executed at one time, that's prior to the Korban, Rabbi Shmuel and Shimon Gamliel. Rabbi Akiva and the others were after the Korban. In any event, the Romans got on to something which really was not understood, perhaps, or certainly carried out by others before them. And they recognized, at least to some extent, and perhaps to a great extent, the success of the Jewish people revolves around their Torah and their religious leaders. And if you want to weaken the Jewish people, if you want to be able to just openly destroy the Jewish people, then, you know, if you can eliminate Torah study and eliminate their Torah leaders, then you're going to have a considerably easier time of doing that. That's what the Romans recognized. Now, it's true, this is a subject of a more detailed discussion, during the days of Hanukkah, Antiochus, there were also decrees against the public the study of Torah, but that was really, it's not parallel. It's for different reasons, which can be demonstrated from historical sources, not for right now. But when it comes to the Romans, clearly here, they wanted to eliminate Torah study and eliminate the Torah leaders. Rabbi Akiva, perhaps, is the most well-known of the stories. It's recorded in the Gemara in the end of Brachas, the Gemara in Menachas, other places, the Gemara and Midrashim, tells of what happened to Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was most likely, I think, it's hard to rank, but certainly a seminal figure among the Tanoim, because the Gemara tells us that the Talmid of Rabbi Akiva, who developed the Mechilta Sifros Sifrei, and so on, was Kulam Aliva de Akiva, says the Gemara. So Akiva, of course, the major figure, and yet the Akiva met this terrible end, where he was tortured to death, and we know it was belief in B'chol Lavavcha, B'chol Nafshecha, in the literal sense, the Torah records in the end of Brachas. So the Akiva, I guess, is the more central figure that is mentioned here. Nonetheless, there were others as well, and Rechina ben Trajon, we know, was wrapped in the Sefer Torah, the Gemara records this in Avodah Zarah. So the Python here weaves together many of them. Actually, only eight of them are mentioned here. Behuda ben Doma is not mentioned, Rechina ben Chachinai is not mentioned, according to other versions of Tarfon is one of the Surugar Malchus. Also, the story that we, again, are familiar with from the Piyot on Yom Kippur, the Slich on Yom Kippur, is an interesting story because it would appear that this, at least the way the story is presented, was that this relates to revenge because of what happened with Yosef. Right? Yosef was sold into slavery by his brothers, and therefore these 10 Jews were executed. There's a simple mathematical problem with that, and that is, if we pause and think for a moment, the maximum number of the brothers of Yosef that could have been involved in the sale was 9. Because Reuven, we know, left. Reuven had this plan, he was going to throw him in the pit, I'll get him later on. And Reuven comes and finds that Yosef had been removed from the pit, he was quite nervous about what had happened. So it doesn't appear that Reuven participated. Yosef, of course, was the victim, and Binyamin was a young man, was not part of it either. So that only leaves 9. So how do you get from the 9 to the 10? Well, again, we can argue that the piyut is for dramatic effect, it's for, it's for didactic effect. But one could also argue, suggested, I don't recall seeing this anywhere, just a suggestion, that Yosef himself shares some of the guilt. And although Yosef didn't sell himself, but he was not an innocent bystander. Yosef did not approach things in the right way either. So maybe the number 10 is a valid number, after all. There's much to say about the Asara Ger Malchus in general, because the concept of martyrdom is something which will come up now in other kinnas. We haven't said anything at this point about martyrdom, and this is the first time that it comes up in the kinnos, and it's a theme that will reverberate throughout some of the other kinnas, especially some of the kinnas relating to the Crusades and what the Jews had to go through at that time. And the phrase Akedah comes to mind. First, Akedah says Rosh Tevis, Al Kiddush Hashem. But of course, that's the first act of a Jew being willing to, so to speak, give up his life, Avraham Yitzchak. And Rav Soloveitchik said, I don't recall that he said it here in regards to Tisha B'Av, but on other occasions, he said that it's really the willingness of Yitzchak to be sacrificed, the willingness of Avraham to sacrifice his child that instilled within the Jewish people, that's a remarkable ability, which again was called upon, so to speak, and was observed on other occasions as well. The people are called the Arze HaLavanon, the cedar tree of Levanon, a reference to the great Talmid HaChamim. And again, the story of the Asara Ger Malchus that we bear in mind as well, to look ahead to something else. In this kinnah, it tells the story of Chanan ben Trajon, who, as we know, was wrapped in a Sefer Torah, and the Sefer Torah was burned, and according to the Gemara, he said that, this has halachic implications, because he was originally tied up, and he had wet sponges tied to him so that the burning would be prolonged, and he passed him when the question came up, if you can remove the wet sponges, Now that would hasten his death. The question that comes up, the halacha lemaisa, not for Tisha B'av, but you know, when he's talking about hastening somebody's death with treatments, you know, or not having treatments, do not resuscitate, these other things, again, comes up halacha lemaisa, and the poskim refers to this gemara, that there's a difference in actively causing somebody's death and removing something which is preventing it, or which is delaying it. Again, I'm not asking now for halacha, but there does come up lemaisa. But what's also interesting is that Herman Trajan says that he saw the words of the Sefer Torah fly up to heaven. The parchment burned, right, but not the words. Now that's something which many years later, and it refers to a kinnah that will say towards the end, Shalish Sufa Ba'esh, the Barami Rutenberg, who witnessed the burning of the Talmud in Paris in the 1200s, when they had a public burning of copies of all the extant copies, or many of the extant copies of the Gemara at that time were burned in a public square in Paris. Abraham Rutenberg was a young man and witnessed this, and he wrote to the kinnah that will say towards the end of the kinnah, Shalish Sufa Ba'esh, and also drew upon that and was reminded that although the books are burning, but the words continue to live on. Although these people, Paris, these great Asaro Gemalchus, Bisham Gamliel, Bishmal, Bikiram, Tatman, and Prophet of Tarchan, and all the others that are mentioned here, but it's interesting that the words very, very much live on. We still speak about Rabbi Kiva says, in the present tense, Athena says, Bishmal says, Bisham Gamliel says, we don't say said, we say says, you know, because although they were tortured to death, they died. Nevertheless, their words live on. This kinnah begins, Achrish Menav Adabero. It's interesting, it's not clear exactly which event this kinnah is referring to. Historically, it seems to be certainly from the time of the Crusades and the tremendous suffering. Those who are not familiar with the background of the Crusades, because we have a number of kinnahs about it, one will be a little bit later. More detail, Mitain Roshi Mayim, which perhaps should have appeared here. But in any event, the Crusades did not, there's no particular direct connection to Tisha B'Av in terms of the Crusades. But we mourn on Tisha B'Av not only the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash, but also the various other tragedies that befell the Jewish people. The Rav writes in dramatic fashion that every Jewish community is a Beis HaMikdash, right? I'll read again from his words. I've spoken many times about the power of custom. Every community had its own character, its traditions, its customs, and its scholars who were concerned with perpetuating them. Is this not too a Beis HaMikdash? Is this not just as sacred and holy as the Beis HaMikdash in Jerusalem? If the Beis HaMikdash was holy and sacred, and we weep and grieve because it was destroyed, how much more sacred were the Jewish communities made up of thousands of great Torah scholars who were destroyed during the Crusades? I'll get back to the background in a moment. They too are a Beis HaMikdash. If we speak about the Churban Beis HaMikdash in a material sense, we also mention the Churban Beis HaMikdash in a spiritual sense, namely the destruction of centers of Torah and the extermination of the great scholars and the great institutions of Torah. And the Rav notes, Gemara tells us, the death of the righteous is just as disastrous and as catastrophic as the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Their massacre weighs no less than the burning of the house of God, its porch, and its palace. The slaying of Gedol Yisrael also warrants mourning and ashes no less than the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Now the Crusades began, by the way, the idea, it goes back to Yirmiyahu himself and his kinnah on Yoshiyahu that we spoke about earlier. I mean, we read the kinnah here, but in Megillas Eicha, the Tarek Dalet talks of as Yirmiyahu's kinnah on Yoshiyahu. Again, the leaders and so on, the tzaddikim, that also is worthy of mourning. Now, the Crusades were called in the year 1096, in the spring of the year 1096, not Tisha B'Av time. Basically, the idea of the Crusades, just to quickly for those who are not familiar, was that at the time, 1096, the Holy Land was under the control of the Muslims. And the Christians, who considered Jerusalem to be a holy place and the land to be a holy land for their religion as well, would not please, the Pope was not pleased that it was the Muslims, the infidels, you know, who were in control of their holy places and the Holy Land. And so he called the crusade that those worthy Christians should travel to the Holy Land and liberate Jerusalem from the control of the Muslims, which they did initially, but then subsequently, not a long amount of time, lost it back to the Muslims, lost it to the Muslims again. But in any event, that was the message or the goal of the Crusades, to liberate Jerusalem, and specifically, you know, the Holy Land, the holy sites, from the control of the Muslims, and to kill those non-believers who followed a different religion. That was the Pope's call. Now, somebody came up with the idea, maybe a lot of people came up with the idea, that, listen, you know, it's nice to schlep to the Holy Land, it was a trip, you know, from Europe to the Holy Land, and we take care of the infidels there, but you know, there's no shortage of infidels right here in Europe. There are Jews right here in Europe, we might as well kill them as well. After all, here we're going to the Holy Land to get rid of those who, you know, are non-believers in our religion. There are plenty right here in our own backyard. So along the way, they took it upon themselves to massacre various Jewish communities. Again, a kinnah that we'll say shortly, not this one, the one begins Mi Yitain Rosh Yimayim, actually mentions the names of the major Jewish communities in Ashkenaz that were destroyed during the Crusades. They're mentioned by name, and included in the kinnah, not, again, not this coming kinnah, included in the kinnahs, though, is the dates as to when these tragedies took place to be and befell these particular Jewish communities. Now, this kinnah, what's interesting is, it doesn't say when it happened. But I think I've noted in the past that that's part of the tragedy, because it could have been any time. That's really the history of the Jewish people. All of this suffering and all of these tragedies don't necessarily relate to a particular time. I mean, obviously it does. We don't know, I don't know, and I haven't seen in the commentaries here, a clear description. Again, in the article it says it's of unknown authorship, so we don't know who authored it, we also don't know which tragedy it was referring to, but that's that itself is the tragedy of Jewish history. It could have been one of any number of such tragedies. And here we speak, continuing the theme of martyrdom, and that's why it's juxtaposed to the kinnah that we just read about the Arzei Levanon, you know, the Sargon Malchus, the theme of martyrdom, because here it's martyrdom as well. They called upon each other, basically, rather than give in to the, you know, to the oppressors. So they killed themselves, they killed their own children. Again, something that happened on more than one particular occasion. You'll see it in the stanza. Let's find which stanza it is. Vishvadu, the third stanza starts Er Elim. So they gathered themselves to sanctify the name of Kiddush Hashem, and each person encouraged the other not to give in to the other religion, to bow to other gods and so on, and including the children. They simply allowed themselves to be killed. They killed them, killed each other. They killed their own children rather than give in to other religions. And in fact, it says, you know, in a kind of a very strong term, it says, they said to their children, "Lo zachino legadelchem laTorah." We haven't had the zechus, unfortunately, to be able to raise you in the way of Torah, because again they assume they're going to be killed and so on. Nakrivchem ka'olah v'haktorah. So instead, we'll sacrifice you like a korban olah, like an offering. And of course, when such a thing happened, they have a famous expression a couple of stanzas later: "Torah, Torah." It's like the Torah itself has to mourn, because it's for the sake of Torah that all these terrible tragedies happen. So that's this kinnah relating to martyrdom at some point in Jewish history, most likely during the Crusades. So the next kinnah, Desnovi Chatosi Shmima, tells the story about the daughter of Rabbi Yishmael, the Kohen Gadol, and this is Rabbi Yishmael ben Elisha, the Kohen Gadol, not the Rabbi Yishmael of Akiva. In any event, the story of his son and his daughter, the famous story that they're taken away and sold into slavery. They end up, the boy being sold to one individual, the girl to another, and of course, the masters don't know or care that that would be brother and sister, and they enter into some sort of an agreement that they'll, you know, mate these two, and they'll have children who are slaves and so on. And each one, of course, not knowing who the intended mate is, you know, mourns and weeps. How could it be? You know, I'm a descendant of Aaron. How can I sleep with some woman who's just a, you know, a slave, and she has the same thing, you know, Bas Yocheved, I'm a married Evan. This is the story of Bno Vito Shom Yishmael, and they both, when they realize who each one is, so they die together, and the souls depart at the same time. So this is the kinah over here. Now, again, it seems to be somewhat out of place, because this would have made more sense, perhaps, at an earlier stage, because it relates to the Chorban. We've already moved on to the martyrdom of the Crusades, and not after this kinah, but after the next one, we're going to go back to the Crusades. Again, what is it, you know, is it out of order? So the Rav made a suggestion. Again, I read his words. He says, the sequence here is strange. It is correct that HaCharishim Imenu, that's the kinah we just read about the Crusades, should follow after Arzi Alavana on about the 10 martyrs. But immediately after this, this kinah for Haruge Ashkenaz, should have come the kinah Mitein Rosh Imayim, which a couple of kinahs later, the one about the Crusades, where spires, worms, and Mayans are mentioned by name, as I alluded to earlier, and where the dates of the destruction are explicitly stated. Instead, we interrupt the story of the destruction of the Jewish communities in Germany and interject the story of the death of the son and the daughter of Rabbi Shmuel. In light of such immense catastrophes, why should we remember the story of an individual boy and girl who were taken captive and enslaved? Rabbi Akiva did not die in the story, nor did Rabbi Elazar Gadol. We are mourning only for a young boy and a young girl who died for the sanctification of God's name. Why? We have, the Rav answers, we have just mourned, it says further, we have just mourned and grieved for the destruction of a state, a land, the Beis HaMikdash, that changed Jewish history and Jewish destiny. We have just mourned and grieved for the massacre and martyrdom of the 10 greatest leaders and scholars, the Chachmei HaTalmud, who were responsible for the transmission of Torah Shebaal Peh. We have just mourned and grieved for the death of thousands and tens of thousands of people, of entire communities, of the largest and greatest communities in the Middle Ages, the Crusades, both spiritually and numerically. These were all tremendous national catastrophes that have lingered on to this day. And now suddenly we are reminded of a story about two individuals, a young boy and a young girl, who suffered because of the fact that Jerusalem was conquered. Are their deaths so important that they should be perpetuated along with all the most catastrophic events in our history? After all, the death of two individuals doesn't change Jewish history. The answer is clear, says the Rav. We Jews have a different understanding. In Yahadus, the suffering of an individual, even an unknown individual, matters. We mourn for two individuals, a young boy and a young girl, in the same manner as we mourn for the 10 martyrs or for those who were killed during the Crusades. We have a special kina just for them, as if not two people were involved, but many hundreds of thousands. Who is supposed to remember an individual boy and girl taken captive by some slave traders? We are. We do not forget the individual even in the midst of national disaster and upheaval, even when we are telling the story of the greatest of all the disasters in our history, the Churban Beis HaMikdash. We mourn not only for the Jews of Worms, not only for the Jews of Mayence, not only for Churban Yerushalayim, not only for the Beis HaMikdash. We also mourn for two young individuals whose lives and death did not change Jewish destiny, who did not play a major public role, who are not leaders or scholars. Simply speaking, a young boy and a young girl are as important to us as our greatest leaders. Some people are so engrossed in national tragedy that they forget the individual. But Yadlus is different. It is very important for us to remember the individual even during a time of national distress. This is typical of Yadlus and our approach to tragedy. Finally, it is important to realize that this tragedy too was a result of the Churban. If not for the Churban, this boy and girl would have been brought up by Rabbi Shmuel the Kohen Gadol in luxury and opulence and would not have suffered. Everything is a result of the Churban Beis HaMikdash. It was responsible for many catastrophes and many disasters, and we remember them all on Tisha B'Av. The next kinah, Churban Beis HaMikdash, Kihuras V'Chihudash, describes sort of a summary of the plundering of the Beis HaMikdash. And again, the order is somewhat questionable. It is a piyut from Rosh HaKalir, but it describes not only the fact that the Beis HaMikdash was not only destroyed as a building, but rather the place was looted and plundered as well. One interesting comment that I'll call to your attention relates to the Kruvim in the test stanza. So it mentions, Tosu Amun Amavim V'Hotziu HaKruvim U'V'Chliva Hayosam Sam Hinei Kechol Agayim Beis Yehuda Chashuvim. People made fun of the Jews because here they allegedly rejected idolatry. Obviously, to make idols is the height of the example of Avodah Zarah,
And yet, right in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holies, always, what do you have on top of the Aron? The Kruvim, which looked like idols. And that's what they said. Hinei kechol ha-goyim beisu u'chashuvim. They took the Kruvim out. Oh, you guys are the same as everybody else. You talk a good game, but in your holiest of holy places, you have the same type of idols that we have. And again, it's just a note of the sort of the mockery which accompanied these events as well. And at the very end of the Kina, we find the statement, Ozavti es Fesi es Nachali Natoshti. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, you know, I've abandoned my temple and forsaken my estate. Now, of course, this is a terrible thing, but it does hint a little bit at the Nechama of Tisha B'Av as well. I alluded last night to the fact that Tisha B'Av is in some of the sense a paradoxical day. It has a certain yomtiv quality to it. You know, we don't say tachanun on Tisha B'Av, we omit, we'll not say a little makenot mincha, we omit certain things that are characteristic of the finest people, and yet it's the saddest day. You know, there's sort of this paradoxical quality to it. But it's a day of nechama as well. And Chazal tell us, you know, there's a mizmor, until a mizmor osaf, mizmor of Kim Bo, going to Achlasecha, so the Tillim speaks about the Kadosh Baruch Hu's Nachala, that's alluded to at the end of this kinah, Nachlasin and Tashti, being invaded by the enemy. And the question is, what do you mean mizmor? Mizmor is a song. You don't sing when tragedy happens. Instead of saying mizmor, it's to say kinah. Not mizmor. What's the kinah? The answer is no, there's a mizmor because Sof goes over at the end of the day. Kadosh Baruch Hu is Shofach Chamos Aleitzim Bavonim. Kadosh Baruch Hu poured out his wrath on stones and on wood. It's really, perhaps, it was the people. As people, we should have been destroyed as a nation for these events. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't. HaKadosh Baruch Hu destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. That's bad enough, and he removed himself from it. But there's a hidden nechama in that he did not take his wrath out on us. Rather, as it says at the end of this kinah, it's Nachlosi Natashti. Chumah Beis HaMikdash, Kiruas. Next kina begins with Yitain Rosh Yimayim. So this is the kina to which I referred before, a kina on the destruction of the major Jewish Torah centers, major Jewish communities of Ashkenaz, the time of the Crusades. Again, the names are mentioned, the dates are mentioned. In the third stanza, Akonin Mar Ale Harugi Ashpira, that spires Basheni Bishmonabo, the second month, the eighth of the month, when that took place. Kahal Vermeiza, says for that's worms. Kahal Vermeiza, the Essim Shlosha Bechodesh Zivlataro, and then Bechodesh Ashlishi Bekriyas Halel, the third month when he said Halel, that's the reference, the third month of Sivan. So either is referring to Rosh Chodesh or to Shavuos. And then Valadire Kahal Magensa, Mayens, that community Bechodesh Ashlishi Beshlishi, the third of the third month. Achodesh Hashem Epach Liyagam Bitzara, a month of happiness, which turned into a month of tragedy. Biyom Matan Das, the day of the giving of the religion, that's the giving of our Torah, of course, is a reference to Shavuos. The Crusades, as we mentioned, had nothing to do with Tisha B'Av, but it's in this kinah that we come across the phrase which the Briska Rav cited, and Soloveitchik, his nephew, agreed to it, and others as well, the phrase where it says, V'chi ein lahosiv moed sheva v'saveira. I don't want to weigh in on the issue now, but just to bring it up. Following the Holocaust, so there was a decision made in the Medinat Israel, in the state of Israel, to have a day to remember the Holocaust. It's called Yom HaShoah. It's observed on the 27th. Of Nisan. Now there's some who have issues with that particular date. It's during the month of Nisan, which you know we usually don't mourn publicly in the month of Nisan in terms of saying Avarachamim, we're saying Yizkor and Kelmoli and so on. But aside from the date, the question it would have been up to me, I would have suggested Kristallnacht as an appropriate date for Yom HaShoah. would have avoided all those problems, and it was the beginning of the beginning of the Holocaust. But many objected to the establishment of a separate day because Tisha B'Av is the day of mourning for the Jewish people, whether or not the event in question happened on Tisha B'Av. Now, the fact of the matter is, you know, World War I broke out on Tisha B'Av, and those who are students of history know that the World War II was not just that happened to be the second, you know, there's one and two, but they were directly related. World War II was a direct, let's say, God forbid, there'd be a World War III now, it wouldn't be an extension of World War II. The world has changed in many, many different ways politically, and so it wouldn't be an extension, not at least not a direct extension. World War II was a direct extension of World War I, so in some sense, the Holocaust is also a product of something that happened on Tisha B'Av. But even without that, the fact remains that the day, as we mentioned last night, I alluded to earlier as well, is a day that is Muchon L'Puranos. That's the, you know, it's Yom Chayav. That's what the Gemara calls it. Again, that Gemara in Pinus, which I mentioned earlier, Megalgalin Achiyav L'Yom Chayav. This is the day. And maybe, I alluded to last night about projecting forward, it's not only projecting forward to other events that happened on Tisha B'Av. For example, the expulsion of the Jews from Spain happened in 1492 on Tisha B'Av. We know that. The Abarbanel, who was among those Jews, writes in his commentary to Yirmiyahu about it. He also writes about the fact that the first Jews who were expelled from the community of Europe was in England, in the 1200s. And Rabbi Rosenfeld's edition, he has kinos on Rosenfeld's edition of the kinos. He was a British, so they have kinos that the communities there recite. It's not printed, I think, in the regular kinos. But in any event, that happened also on Tisha B'Av, as Abarbanel writes. As we don't have, as far as I know, other records that the expulsion of the Jews from England was on Tisha B'Av, but Abarbanel, in his essay in Yirmiyahu, recalling, you know, the event that he personally experienced, the expulsion from Spain, that happened on Tisha B'Av, so he mentions that the expulsion from England was also on Tisha B'Av. Anyway, this is the day that is Muchon L'Puranos, and therefore the Rav and others said that that's the day when we mourn all Jewish tragedies, whether they happen to be on the calendar day called Tisha B'Av or not, that's the day that it's observed. And in this kinnah, it mentions v'chi ein lahosif moed shavus haver. Shouldn't we don't add, even though these events of the Crusade were terrible events, great Jewish communities wiped out, Torah centers, and again individual people slaughtered at the hands of the Crusades, tremendous kiddush Hashem of the, you know, the parents are giving up their children and so on. We don't have a separate day. Now, obviously, this kinnah is not necessarily classically a halachic source, not a psak. But nonetheless, this is what, when they asked the Brisker Rav about it, he did not want, he felt that, no, it's Tisha B'Av, and the Rav believed in that very much as well. We don't inaugurate new days of Tzara. Again, you know, I didn't live through the Holocaust. I can't relate to that level to the people who did, and they felt they wanted something. I'm not weighing in, but our tradition is that tragedies are observed on Tisha B'Av, and therefore certainly we say kinnis that relate to the Crusades, but again, that's the line which is some quote is saying that even though the events were worthy of days of mourning, worthy of, but in terms of national experience, Tisha B'Av is our national day of mourning. Me, Tein Rosh Yimari. The next kina is Oz Baloch Yimiyah Al Kivrei Avos, a kina based on a famous medrash to the Psichta of Echa Rabosi, I think in where Yirmiyahu HaNavi goes, or is encouraged to go, and wake up the Avos that they should daven, that the Korban shouldn't happen. And of course, Yirmiyahu initially is hesitant to do it. He doesn't want to. And when he comes to them, they ask him, what's going on? What do you want? Why are you here? And he's embarrassed to admit it. Presumably because he feels that he'll be the victim of their taina, you know, this happened on your watch. When we were leaders of Klal Yisrael, these things didn't happen. Yirmiyahu had a certain sense of personal embarrassment or shame that this happened while he was the leader of the Klal Yisrael. Nevertheless, he went, and here, of course, is that Avram cries out to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, what about all the things that I did, the promise you made to me, and Yitzhak and Yaakov? And each time HaKadosh Baruch Hu had an answer. The kinnah ends in a slightly different way than the medrash ends. And the kinnah ends, the imahos begin to cry as well, Leah and Rachel and Zilpah and Bilhah, and finally HaKadosh Baruch Hu says in the end, Shuvu smimim minuchaschem, Male amale kol mishaloseichem. I'll answer all of your prayers. We're more familiar with the, based on the pasuk in Yirmiyahu, the kol v'rama nishma, the lamenting voice of Rachel crying, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu hearing her crying, responding to her tears. It's not exactly the way the kina ends. Kina says it's like a joint effort, and we're usually used to hearing Rachel. I don't know if Rabbi Twersky's in the room. He mentioned to me a few weeks ago a story. My mother's grandfather was a Yerushalmi Jew, ended up as a rabbi in Atlantic City, New Jersey, had to run away from the Turks, the story. And it was his father, like the great-great-great-grandfather, whatever it is, Yeshua Tzvi Michal Shapiro. Rosh Michal Shapiro was known as one of the tzaddikim of Yerushalayim in the days of the old Yishuv. But the Masas, he had a son, Rabbi Tzion. Tversky told me he heard a story once that Rabbi Tzion Shapiro and his son, Rabbi Moshe Shapiro, was my mother's grandfather, once they lived in Yerushalayim and had to go somewhere and were outside of near Kever Rachel to Ramat Rachel. And they were staying there overnight. And Rabbi Tzion kept asking his son, kept waking up during the course of the night, and he couldn't, it was a fitful sleep, and he couldn't fall asleep, and he kept waking up after he dozed off. And his son asked him, what's the problem? And he said, don't you hear the crying? Isn't that keeping you awake? He heard the crying from Kever Rachel. Obviously, it's not in the, I'm sure he didn't actually literally, I don't know, didn't literally hear crying, but it was so in tune with the idea of Kol Barama Mishma that it actually, it impacted him. So this is the idea in this kina. Here again, it speaks about all the emos, and perhaps by extension of the others as well. Malai malai kol mishalo seichem, but that's the havtacha of eventually the shavuvon and livvulon. Oz baloch yemiyahu al tivei avos. Next kina, oz milo sefek, relates an unusual story. The Yirmiyahu coming out and meeting a woman or someone who appears to be a woman. It's described by Rav Elazar Kalir as Isha Yefas Tor Menuvelas, almost a contradiction. Someone who's beautiful and yet disgusting looking at the same time, repulsive. And somehow, as it goes on, represents the Jewish people. And it's interesting because this kinah ends with the request to Yirmiyahu to go, Kum Lech Yirmiyahu Lama Secha Lech Kol Avos Aharon Moshe, go call the Avos. Maybe this kinah should have appeared before the last one. But in any event, here this strange story of this woman who was once beautiful and at the same time unattractive and repulsive. This represents the Jewish people. And Yirmiyahu speaks to her. And she says she's not exactly a regular human being. She represents Knesset Yisrael. And Knesset Yisrael has that quality to it. Knesset Yisrael is at once beautiful and repulsive. Why? The Golos and our suffering has made us repulsive. There's a Mishnah Darim, the son of Vav, about a certain family that wanted to marry off their daughter. And they made a shidduch with somebody, but the son, the boy, the prospective chosam, wasn't interested because he didn't find the girl attractive. And so he took a nether. He was afraid that the parents might push the shidduch anyways. So he took a nether. Afterwards, the family prepared the girl. They got her cleaned up and dressed up and dolled up and so on. And her entire appearance changed. And when he saw her, he regretted taking that nether. Because now he was bound by a nether. So Rabbi Shmuel was matir a neder based on a Pesach, the opening, the halacha, in order to be matir a neder, so you have to find an excuse, basically indicate that had I known all the facts, I wouldn't have taken this neder. That's the yisod, again, on Tisha B'Av, I don't go to the dinim, but that's the yisod of Ataras Nedarim. So Rabbi Shmuel said, had you known that this is what it would look like, would you have taken the neder? And he said, no, and therefore he's released from the neder. But the Mishnah goes on to say that Rabbi Shmuel broke down in tears, and he said, the daughters of Benos Yisrael are all beautiful. Benos Yisrael knows, saying, Elisha Hanius Minavlosan. Their poverty, their suffering, that's what makes them unattractive looking. The Rav, in an essay related to this kin, tells a story about people who suffered. He said that from his own experience, I still remember my own life as a young boy. My father was a rabbi, a prominent rabbi, who was supposed to get paid 18 rubles a week. In reality, I never paid it, but that was what he was supposed to receive. I walked around generally in torn pants, and my classmates in the cheder ridiculed me and persecuted me. A rabbi's son in torn pants seemed funny to them. I remember that one shvat, my mother promised to make me a new pair of pants at Pesach. I was proud and happy. A few weeks later, she told me she couldn't afford to do it. These are the circumstances in which rabbis and Jews lived in Lithuania and White Russia. People were hungry. We don't recognize today how prosperous that we are. But there's something else as well. The Rav relates to a story about a Jew who, because of the Golos, had to change his ways. But internally, he was still beautiful. I always repeat the story that an old Jew in America told me. He came from a small town in Lithuania and arrived in the United States with 16 cents in his pocket. He landed on Ellis Island, the immigration center, and an agent from a sweatshop in New York picked him up. They used to pull in new immigrants and put them in the cellar of a dirty hotel. The owners of the sweatshop used to work them for 10, 12, 14 hours a day, feed them, let them sleep a few hours, and pay them a few dollars a week. They worked under the most galling conditions, but they accepted their lot because they had no alternative. He told me that Mondays and Tuesdays passed this way, and he didn't see the sunshine from the roof of the tenement house down to the basement where he slept the entire week. Friday came, he walked into the room of the owner, the manager got his pay envelope and said, "Good day, I'll see you Monday morning." The manager looked at him and said, "Why Monday? Why not tomorrow?" Answered the man, "Tomorrow, it's Shabbos tomorrow." "What do you mean tomorrow?" "Well," said the manager, "if you don't come in tomorrow, don't come in Monday, you don't have a job." So he got another job. Once again, the whole week was good. But when he told his manager he couldn't come in on Shabbos, he lost his job. Finally, he began to starve, and once a policeman found him on a bench in Central Park. After trying four times, he finally went to the manager and told him that he was ready to violate Shabbos. He became a Mechal Shabbos. But later, as soon as he could, he got out of the business and became a strict Shomer Shabbos again. The Rav said this precisely is a small statement. The Jew would like to stay home on Shabbos and not go to the factory. Many American Jews slipped. It was a question of employment. Either you come in or you don't have a job. Benoz Yisrael knows Haim. But many trip because anius and have lost on poverty, hunger, gullus, worry make them ugly. It's true literally and it's true symbolically as well. Osimo Sefer Gavrikas Yisrael. The next kina is Eich Tenachamuni Hovel or Hevel. Again, just describing the enormity of the tragedy of the Churban. And what's interesting is that the Kina speaks about different times and different sufferings that the Jewish people experience at the hands of different enemies, many of whom are mentioned by name in this Kina. The one thing it says towards the earlier part of the Kina is that the once busy city, right? Echa asked how a city at one time so filled and so teeming with activity is now alone and desolate. Just to mention, the Rav tells a story here from somebody he heard from somebody after following the Holocaust. I mentioned last night about people returning home to places they didn't, I mentioned actually this morning also, people returning to places and not recognizing what it was, the Shovas, I mentioned at the very beginning of the Kinos. The Rav records the story here. Someone once told me an experience he had that was later published in a short story. In 1945, right after he was liberated from the Nazis and the first high holidays after Lithuania was conquered by the Russian forces and liberated from Nazi rule, he returned to Vilna, where he had lived before it was occupied by the Germans. It's very hard to describe what Vilna used to look like on Rosh Hashanah and Kippur. In one neighborhood, there were eight or nine shuls that had minyanim. There were old shuls, Nusaf Svard shuls, other shuls. One shul was called the Kauta shul, the cold shul, because they could not heat it and couldn't daven there in the winter. The oldest were the Beis HaKnesses Sagra, the Kavanesha shul, an old shul that dated back to the Middle Ages. This person remembered what the shulhof, the area where all the shuls were congregated, looked like in Kippur. Tens of thousands of Jews used to come daven in these shuls on the night of Kol Nidre. Everyone used to come. Who did go to shul in Yom Kippur? But this time, after 1945, everything was quiet and silent. He didn't see a single soul. On that Kol Nidre night, he went to the shul where his mother used to daven to see what it looked like now after the Holocaust. And he used an expression found in the Kinnah. He said, "Early mitain Rosh Mayim. Where is the Torah and the Talmud knows who studied it? Behold, their place is desolate with none to dwell therein." He then told me a strange story. His mother was a pious Jewish woman, as all Jewish mothers were so many years ago. And of course, on Yom Kippur, she used to go to shul to daven. She had a cat, And when it came time for Mafti Yonah, she used to leave the shul to go home and feed the cat. After all, the cat is not obligated to fast in Yom Kippur. The cat used to wait for her, and after she got through feeding it, she went back to shul. This man knew the cat. That year, he spent the whole day in the home where his parents had lived, and around 4:30, the time when they used to read Mafti Yonah, the time when his mother used to feed it, the cat scratched at the door. You see, when a place is desolate, it is tragic, but when a place is desolate of human beings, but animals prowl around it, it is almost unbearable. That's the idea of Har Tzion. It's bad enough that Har Tzion Shashomim, but surely Hilkubo, the fox or the cat or whatever it is that walks by. The only link between the past and the present is the cat. All this man saw were the remnants of the shuls and a cat walking among the debris and the ruins of the shuls, and this was unbearable pain. That's the enormity of, another example of the enormity of the tragedy related to modern times as well. The next kina, Amarti Shumeni Bevchia Morer, is a kina ostensibly from the time of the Crusades, where there was a couple of phrases I call to your attention. This one, it says, Hein l'umim es nikvotsu. Towards the end of the stanza. Just a moment. Starts with a hey. And it refers, therefore, to a type of organized destruction. There was nobody more organized in terms of destroying Jews than the end of the hey stanza. Amchayam Yisodji Yisotsu. They got together and kind of organized destruction. Nobody was more organized than the Germans. I think I've mentioned in the past that one of the chilling films that I ever saw relating to the Holocaust did not have, if I can recall, one scene of a concentration camp or of a pogrom or of anybody being killed or anybody suffering and so on a correct level. It was not at all that kind of film. It was a film about the so-called Wannsee Conference. Wannsee was a city where the Nazi leadership got together for the purpose of planning the extermination of the Jewish people. And Eichmann and all the leaders were there. And it's really there that they introduced the concept, or came up with the idea of the gas chamber and so on, and they were going to move all of Europe's Jews to these concentration camps. And what's staggering about it was, at least to me anyway, was that they sat and talked like it was at a business meeting. I'm not in the business world, but you had flow charts and diagrams, because you had to figure out. You had so many Jews that had to be moved from different places. So, it was an engineering operation. How many trains did we have available? How many people can be brought from place A to place B? How long will it take? It was extremely organized, and you might have been talking about moving coffee beans one place to another. A business person in the coffee bean exporting business would have a meeting with his people and figure out, okay, we got to transport this number of beans to this place by that date. We got to transport this. What type of vehicles are available? How much can they carry? And so I found that incredibly chilling. We were talking about human lives. And there was and the waitresses or whatever just came in with coffee and tea and cake and a while. It really was like a business meeting. And I just, as I say, I found it to be without any, certainly there's no gore or descriptions of direct suffering in this film at all, but it was chilling to see how it can be approached. You could approach describing or planning the destruction of human lives like you were moving, commodities from one place to another. The Germans, of course, were very, very well organized and things, and then they were successful. To the extent that we know that they were, and that's Hein Lume Eis Nikvotsu. They got together in order, put things together in an organized, a very organized fashion. The other thing I mentioned in this kina is there's a reference also to Bein Nishcha to Av Korei Shema, Eim Avonim Smecha, the concept of martyrdom, and also the expression relating to what seems to be an old hobby, so to speak, of those who want to make the Jews, and that is starting up with who want to harm the Jews, and starting up with their beards. We've seen pictures in terms of the Holocaust. They would mock the Jews by making them shave their beards or cut off their payas, or in a public way.
And it's not something evidently that was invented by the Nazis. We find that as well in the time of the Crusades. Amarti shumenet v'chiyam arei. Next kinim ha'onei shamayim, the theme we discussed earlier, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu can't really be contained even in the heavens, and certainly not in the Beis HaMikdash. Nonetheless, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was mitzamtzein and constricted his shechina, so to speak. I'm careful how we say it, and was willing to fit in the bias. Every stanza here concludes with the word bias. Obviously, referring the kinnah to the Beis HaMikdash, and ends with the hope that HaKadosh Baruch Hu again will return. Ronei Shammai. I mentioned earlier the parallel between Yetzias Mitzrayim, celebrating Yetzias Mitzrayim, retelling the events on Pesach night, and unfortunately having to recall the events of the Churban on Tisha B'Av, the idea of the parents having to transmit that to children to make it alive. And this kinnah, Eshtu Kad Bekirbi, contrasts leaving Mitzrayim and leaving Yerushalayim. We know that the way our Luach is set up, the first day of Pesach is always the same day of the week as Tisha B'Av. Whenever it is the first Seder is Wednesday night, as it was this year, so Tisha B'Av is Wednesday night, Thursday, etc. It's one of the arrangements of our calendar. And there are connections between Tisha B'Av and Pesach night. It's actually, according to some poskim, the reason that we have an egg, a beitz on a Seder plate. Again, the Vilna Gaon reject this outright, but others suggest that the reason we have an egg on a Seder plate is because we recall the Avelus of the Churban. Again, the Gaon thinks that not appropriate for Pesach night, but nonetheless, there's a connection between the absence of the Beis HaMikdash and Pesach night. But here, the contrast is between leaving Mitzrayim and leaving Yerushalayim. It goes back to what I said at the outset, that the dignity of Klal Yisrael is described here at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, just the majesty of the event, the beauty of the Yetzias Mitzrayim, the power, the dignity, and the quite reverse, in very, very beautiful terms. I think I mentioned in the past that in some Sephardic traditions, this kin appears to be one of the first ones, because it sort of highlights the distinction in terms of the dignity of Klal Yisrael, the majesty of Yetzias Mitzrayim, contrasted with the tragedy of leaving Yerushalayim. Only again, it ends on a positive note, that eventually things will be restored when Shuvi L'Kadosh Baruch Hu returns to Yerushalayim. Eishtu kad yikir bi b'halosi yali bi b'teisi bi Mitzrayim ini ma'iv l'man ha'shkiv b'teisi Yerushalayim Aja Shimoshe Shilo Yashe B'tei Simi Mitzrayim Mekone Nimiyo V'nohon Nimiyo B'tei Simi Rushalayim B'tei Simi Skonon Rishachan Ha'onon B'tei Simi Mitzrayim Hamas El Shachna Laikan Ono B'tei Simi Rushalayim Galay Amravo Hakamo, B'tei Simi Mitzrayim, Zidunim Shatafo, Maroshi Tafo, B'tei Simi Yerushalayim, Degan Shamayim, Mitzuya Zuhumayim, B'tei Simi Mitzrayim, Lano Rorim, Mayim Hamorim, B'tei Simi Yerushalayim, Ashken the highways, the heroes are horrid. To taste him in Mitzrayim. Korei el Eivel, Al-Maros, Bobel, to taste him in Yerushalayim. Umarei klod Adonai, Teshokheles lefonoi. To taste him in Mitzrayim. The Cherem Natusho, the Tevach Natusho, to taste him in Yerushalayim. Zeba Hamincha v'shemen Hamishcha v'teisim v'mitzrayim Zulashel l'kufa k'tzom v'tincha v'teisim v'yushalayim Chagim v'shavosos v'moksim v'yosos v'teisim v'mitzrayim Chaynis v'eivel v'dof v'hevel v'teisim v'yushalayim Tovu olim, lavodim olim, v'teisim v'mitzrayim, Has as its refrain, Oya and Oy Mehelanu. Again, the description of various different articles, wasn't just the Beis HaMikdash, but various different component parts of the Beis HaMikdash also lacking after the Churban.
That's both our Shoflu.
The next Kina, Evel HaOrer, is actually a short form or a shortened version of the description of the events of the Crusade in 1096. We described it at greater length in an earlier Kina. Here again, this happens, I guess it's juxtaposed to the previous one because it has the shrieking Oyoli and Alalili at the end, but again, a reference to the Crusades as the Zion stanza tells the year, Tuf Tuf Nun Vav 4856, which corresponds to 1096, the year the Crusades began. Evela Orer Anios Agur. The next Kina Yomach Bichbarti is the famous story of the blood of the Navi Zechariah. That's not the Zechariah of Zechariah and Treyosa. That Zechariah and Treyosa was in the beginning of the Bayis Sheni period. The last Navi that we had, Chagah Zechariah Malachi, is an earlier Zechariah ben Yehoyada, and he was stoned to death by Jews in the Beis HaMikdash on the days of the Yehoash. And he was a Kohen. He was innocent. He was a Navi. He was a judge. It was on Yom Kippur, and it was Shabbos, all kinds of different things that they violated at that time. And his blood was not covered for a long time. And when Nebuzradan, the Babylonian general, came in, he saw the blood, and they asked what this blood was from. And they said, well, it's from the, they didn't want to admit that they'd killed, you know, a fellow Jew, a Navi, coin. Well, that's from the, it's from the Karbanos.
but he slaughtered Karbanos, and somehow that was unable to get his blood to disappear, and it was bubbling, and eventually he began to slaughter people, and some, according to the account, 940,000 Jews were slaughtered to get the blood of the Navi to, you know, to stop, and finally Nebuzaradan scouted HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how many more people do I have to kill? So this tragic story is here, and it has the refrain at the end of each stanza, the pasuk in the second parak of the Megillah, just as a P.S., the Gemara says, eventually Nebuzaradan converted. And we find other such statements. The Gemara says, descendants of Haman, studied, became Jewish and studied Torah in Bnei Brak, and descendants of Nebuchadnezzar. I'll just note that that's really the ultimate triumph. These wicked people who wrought so much tragedy on the Jewish people, eventually the Torah, not only did the Torah outlive them and outsurvive them, but they themselves, if not they themselves, their descendants, became contributors to the perpetuation of Torah. That's the ultimate victory, the ultimate triumph over those who wish to destroy us. Yom Achti Chbarati V'Kolovani. And the next kina, the last before the Tzion group, begins with the word Shkura Zolo Miyayin. It describes, so to speak, based on the words of Navi Yeshaya, that we'll have to wake up, you know, from our drunken stupor that led us into the disaster in the first place. And here again a description of the cruelties that happened to the Jewish people. But I would also submit, in coming full circle to what we discussed last night, maybe hear a call as well to wake up from our slumber. Last night I gave the mushel of the lost child who doesn't realize that he's lost. The parents are frantic, looking all over for him in the airport, and they can't find him, and the parents are in a panic situation. And the child is found later on sitting very comfortably, staring out the window, watching the planes take off and land, and doesn't realize that he's lost. So he's not upset. And I said that perhaps typifies our situation. HaKadosh Baruch Hu longs for our return to Eretz Yisrael. The Paschal every day, HaKadosh Baruch Hu laments that his children are exiled from his table. We don't feel it, because we're like the kid staring out the window, watching the planes take off and land, and we don't realize that we're lost. So we're shkura zolo miyayin. It's like we're drunk or not with wine. We don't realize that we're lost, and that's something to wake up to as well.
Shkura zolo miyayin.
The next kina begins a series that starts with the word Tzion. This one, Tzion Alos Yishali, the Shlomo HaSirayach, composed by Yehuda HaLevi. Everyone knows of Yehuda HaLevi's great desire to come to Eretz Yisrael, and the story about when he came there was trampled, and he bent down to kiss the ground. Again, maybe to some extent folklore, but we know that Yehuda HaLevi, from his work, the Sefer HaKuzari, spoke about the beauty of Eretz Yisrael, and that's what this kina is about. The truth of the matter is, we've talked about the mourning, but you know, the pasuk says in Eicha, it says Zochu Yerushalayim may on Yom Rudeha, right? Yerushalayim remembers the days of suffering. We've done that, but also Kol Machmudeh Asher Ha'ad Me'Kedem. There's also glory and beauty in Yerushalayim in the past, and Eretz Yisrael as well. So that's mentioned over here in Nishkin and some of the others. For example, Darah's Lake, I'll just mention a brief reference or two. It speaks about Chayei Neshamos Avir Arzeh. The very air in Eretz Yisrael is different. Like we say, Avir the Ara Machkim, right? There's something about the quality of the air in Eretz Yisrael, the light, the everything is different. Whether physically or not, I don't know, but there's something special. I spoke last week, so there's something that is palpable in terms of Eretz Yisrael. And this kind of ends again with the idea of Mechakev Yegi, I spoke about earlier, waiting for the arrival of Mashiach. Hachakel v'chol yom sheyavo. Tzion alos yishali v'shom the next kiddo begins Tzion Kechi Kol Tzori Gilad Mitzirayach. Again, a reference to some special quality of Eretz Yisrael. A reference to the story in Navi where Naaman, the non-Jewish officer, was cured of his tzaras only by dipping in the Yarden after he tried various other waters, something special about Eretz Yisrael. Even the animals, the birds in Eretz Yisrael, have great intelligence. A reference to the fact that the Chamor, perhaps of Pinchas Ben Yair, who knew not to eat any the produce from which Tumas and Mises weren't taken. Again, some of the natural and supernatural beauty and special qualities of Eretz Yisrael. The next kina, Tzion Ateres Tzvi,
speaks about Yerushalayim also as being the center of the Melucha, Ir HaMelucha, David Shlomo Ben Ois of Benuyo, and there's reference to the Eser Kedushas, the Ten Kedushas of Eretz Yisrael. Also a statement about the Ketores that was brought in the Beis HaMikdash could be smelled all the way Adei Ir HaTzmorim until Yericho. Rivet has a famous comment in Maseches Tamid that it wasn't that it smelled all the way to Yericho, but Dafke in Yericho. Yericho was actually, as the first city conquered by the Jewish people, should have been the city that was the center in terms of the Beis HaMikdash and the Melucha. Yerushalayim was selected instead, but Yericho still had a certain special status, somewhat ironic in light of the contemporary situation, Yericho, but that's the reference here to the Ketores Adei Ir HaTzmorim. The Gemara says that because of the Ketores, the fragrance is so sweet and so powerful, women didn't have to put on makeup or a sweet-smelling fragrant because of what was in the Beis HaMikdash. See on our terrace, see you soon. The next kina begins at Tzion Tekonni Alei Vesech Hashem Nisraf, a description of Tzion as an impoverished widow crying in the street. This is not similar to the other ones that described with so much of beauty or the specialness of Yerushalayim, but rather the mournful nature of the feeling of Tzion now, Tzion B'mar Tivki Mei Menachem, and again a call to go to the Imohos, Sarah and the Rachel and Leah, and Bill and Zilpah mentioned that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will respond to them, the Shavuot and Ligvulam. Tzion Tekoni Alei Vesa. The next kin is Tzion Yedidus Yedid. This is a reference to Yerushalayim, to Tzion being in the Chelek of Binyamin, the Binyamin Amar Yedid Hashem. A couple stanzas later, it says Tzion Yerusha Zev, Binyamin Zev Yitzrav, it was the tribe of Binyamin. It relates to what we said earlier, that Binyamin was not involved in the Chiras Yosef. Yerushalayim is supposed to be a place which Irsha Chubra Yachdav brings Jewish people together, and therefore those who participated in that which separated the Klal Yisrael were not the place that was selected, and their territory was not selected for the place of the Beis HaMikdash, but rather the tribe of Binyamin. Actually, there's a reference here in the Kina to a place called Ein Etam, which the Gemara says was originally, there was a thought to build the Beis HaMikdash there because that was a higher mountain, a higher area, and should be in the highest place. However, they darshan the pasuk by Binyamin. It says, "Uvein k'seifav shachem." The Eretz Yisrael habracha, "Uvein k'seifav shachem." The shoulder is not the highest place, but the next highest place that was selected for the Makom Mikdash again in the shevet of Binyamin. Tzion Yedidus Yedid. The next kinnah is Shalei Sufa Vaish. I referred to it earlier. It's the famous kinnah composed by the Maram Rutenberg, or Meir Rutenberg, was the last of the Balei HaTosus, one of the most important figures in terms of Psak Halacha, Ashkenaz. Maram Rutenberg himself had a very tumultuous life, as many people are aware. He was held captive for the end of his life, and his body was not released for many years afterwards because he refused to let the Jewish people be extorted and pay an outrageous ransom to redeem him. But in any event, Maram Rutenberg's contributions, very often, we have Svarim from Rutenberg, many different editions or versions of his tshuvas, which are now available in a single set of several volumes. The Mordechai quotes from Maram Rutenberg and others, the tour, a very, very seminal figure. Maram Rutenberg composed this kinnah following the events of the burning of 24 wagon loads of copies of Gemara, which were rounded up in France, in Paris in 1242. This was following a debate that was held between a Jewish apostate and one of the Balei HaTosafot V'Chil of Paris. The Art School Kinos has the story at some length. It's worth reading. This is the Kina composed by Maram Rutenberg after this event. Again, I tied it into Rechinim Ben Tradyom. When he died, the Sefer Torah was burnt, but he said the words soar heavenward. Surely that's what Maram Rutenberg had in mind as well. When witnessing the burning of the Talmud in the streets of Paris at the hands of the persecutors at that time, the 1200s. Shalei Sufa Ba'esh L'Shalom V'Lach. The next Kina Tzion Tziras Pe'er focus on the tradition that we have that there's two Yerushalayim. There's Yerushalayim Shel Mala and Yerushalayim Shel Mata. And here there's a conversation between Yerushalayim Shel Mata, Yerushalayim Shel Mata, asked Yerushalayim Shel Mata to plead with HaKadosh Baruch Hu to
finished to settle the solve the Golos once and for all. Tzion Tziras Pe'er Chedvas Agudah
Yisrael. We'll say the last two kinnas back to back. Tzion B'Mishpat and then Tzion Geveres L'Mamlechos Mitzirayach. Both speak about the downtrodden condition, disgraced condition of Tzion, but ends with the hope of Shalom Menucha Drosh U'Shalom Asirayach, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should seek the peace and welfare of the captives, all of us who are in Golos, and bring us back to Tzion. Again, we'll say the last two together. Following that, before Eli Tzion, we will say the kinos printed in the art school kinos and other copies around regarding the Holocaust, but with that from the Bava Rebbe, Zechon Levracha, and from the Rav Schwab. But again, first the last two Tzion kinos. Tzion b'mishpat l'chiloch. I mentioned earlier that the day of Tisha B'Av is designated for all tzaros that befell Klal Yisrael, even those that may not have a direct connection to Tisha B'Av. So we'll say now, as our minig in the shul, two kinos composed in the relatively not long ago, in memory of those who fell, and the martyrs of Churban Europe. One from Shlomo Halberstam, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, the Bava Rebbe, and the second from Rav Schwab, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, the head of the German community in Washington Heights. Both the kinos, again, I don't have it in your particular edition, so look on with somebody who has. Oh, it's printed in the white pamphlets as well. It's worth, if you want to have a moment, to look at the background in each case as to why both of these Gedolei Torah agreed to write these kinos. But very, very moving and important kinos to recite. Zechruna v'konnu kol Yisrael. We conclude with the recitation of Eli Tzion. We say standing. Eli Tzion is the wailing song, the mournful tune, where we compare our suffering to that that was gone through by a woman delivering a child. Great pain and suffering, but just as at the end of that suffering there's something wonderful that emerges, so too that the Nechama of Tisha B'Av, that all the suffering, all the tragedies that we've gone through and depicted during the course of our recitation of Kinos, will end with the ultimate Geula and something positive that we hope will come b'mehera v'yameinu. Kemo isha v'tzira o v'chisolach agur asak haba mireo alei armon asher nutan yash mason adoreo yal biyas mechor feyeo b'som migdash vadoreo Eli Tzion v'yoreho, k'mo isho v'tzireho, chifsulach agur asach, alba mireho, alei golus mishor seyeho, mani meishir z'moreho, v'yal domo masher shubach, k'mo meimei ereho, Eli Tzion v'yoreho, k'mo rishon v'tzireho, v'chir sulach agur asak, albam yoreho, alei hegyon mecholeho, asher domam v'yoreho, v'yalvad asher shomeim, v'vitur sanedreyo, Eli Tzion v'yoreho, Moisha, v'tzireho, v'chiv sulach, agur asak, albam yireho, alei zivchei semideho, v'fijonei dechoreho, yal chilu, chilei heichol, mizbach, v'tzireho, eli tzion v'yoreho, Moisha, v'tzireho, V'chiv sulach agur asak albam yireho Alei tapei melacheho B'nei David yireho Yal yofyom asher choshach Vei soruch v'soreho Eli tzion v'yoreho Ravishah, Tingra, Mechiv Salah, Chagura, Sak, Albal, Yireha, Alei Chavod, Asher Gala, Beis Chorban, Yireha, Yallah, Chay, Tesher Lachav, Yisam Sakim, Chagureha, Elitzion, Yireha, Mawisha, Vesimeha, Chiv Salah, Chagura, Sak, Albal, Yireha, Alei Macha, Turov, Makos, Asher Hukou, Zireho, Yalmi Putz, Alei Selo, Olaleho, Nareho, Elitzion, Yareho, Moisha, Vesimeho, Chiv Salah, Chagura, Sak, Albal, Alei Simcha, Soiveho, Sochaku, Al Shivoreho, Yalinoi, Bnei Chorin, Nibibeho, Soireho, Litzio, Yoreho, Moisho, Vistiheho, Chifsulo, Gurasa, Kalba, Alei Fesha, Asher Yitzho, Zalul Derech Ashireho, Yal Tzivos Kehaleho, Shizufeho, Shechoyveho, Eli Tzion Yoreho, Kmo Isha, Nisiveho, Kisulo, Chagurasa, Albal Mireho, Alei Kolos Mechorfeho, Peis Rabu Figoreho, Yal Rishas Megadfeho, Toch Mishkan Chatzireho, Eli Tzion Yoreho, Kmo Isha, Vistiveho, Chisulo, Chagurasa, Albal Mireho, Alei Shimcho, Asher Chulal, Vikamei Mitzireho, Yal Kacharan Yitzav Chulo, Kishov Ushma Moreho, Eli Tzion Yoreho, Moisha Mitzireho, Chisulo, Chagurasa, Albal Mireho. Show me how to